Remember the swine flu scare of 1976? That was the year the U.S. government told us all that swine flu could turn out to be a killer that could spread across the nation. And Washington decided that every man, woman, and child in the nation should get a shot to prevent a nationwide outbreak, a pandemic.
Dr. David Sensor, then head of the CDC, the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta, is now in private industry. He devised the swine flu program, and he pushed it.
You began to give flu shots to the American people in October of 76.
October 1st.
By that time, how many cases of swine flu around the world had been reported?
There had been several reported, but none confirmed.
Where did this so-called deadly variety of flu, where did it first hit back in 1976? It began right here at Fort Dix in New Jersey in January of that year when a number of recruits began to complain of respiratory ailments, something like the common cold.
Welcome to the Daily Wrap-Up, a concise show dedicated to bringing you the most relevant independent news as we see it from the last 24 hours. Saturday, December 19th, 2020. Thank you for joining me today. I have a really interesting show today, where I'm going to walk you down the timeline, essentially, and actually not even necessarily in its correct order, but I'm going to walk you through the timeline of essentially how our government, and it's not just our government, that's important to understand, but in a sense, how our government, as I am an American broadcasting from in the United States, where I can affect the most change as far as my citizenship and where I live, that we will see that our government has allowed the rise of this biosecurity state. In fact, seeing exactly the kind of things that most people, for the first time, are becoming aware of during this COVID-19 illusion. But understand that I'm going to show you that the government that's supposed to be watching out for you, or so we're told, has ignored and overlooked and hidden those exact same kind of markers and concerns for decades. Numerous times, Congress has collected and talked about the pharmaceutical influence over FDA and CDC, you know, regulatory capture, these things that are conspiracy theory. They've talked about those in open session in Congress, but it's conspiracy theory, though. It's incredible. And the important part here is to see how they've allowed this to grow and not just suddenly discovering these things that most Americans are, you know, even right now, not even sure whether they can trust, but certainly becoming aware of in the conversation, I should say, wondering whether there are fake news on Twitter as other scientists and doctors and experts speak out and point to it, and they get dismissed and disparaged by the mainstream scientists? No, the mainstream doctors. Oh, no, excuse me. The mainstream journalists? No, that's not right either. The mainstream talking heads that tell you what they're supposed to tell you. Sure, let's listen to those people. But there's a lot to get into today in regard to the mortality discussion, too. The idea of this, it's really actually a quick point in the beginning here, but the idea of what we talked about previously in regard to, you know, mortality of past years compared to this year. And I don't care what anybody tries to play the game of numbers with, which is what they're doing in this entire thing. If comparing previous years and total death, factoring in a growth of the population, which we can see on the escalation of the deaths throughout the years anyway, looking at it, it's damn near close to where we would have been hypothetically without this happening. If you would have asked people, factoring in the population, what would you think our total deaths for the country would be, probably would be right about where we are now. And that's what I'll show you in a minute. Now, that's only numbers and statistics. The point is for you to take from that what you will. I'm not telling you exactly what this absolutely means. I have my opinions on it. But the fact that you're not supposed to consider why that's interesting says everything as far as I'm concerned. But I'm also going to talk about H1N1 specifically today. There's kind of a carrying point throughout the whole show today that is about H1N1. Not just because of that one specific fake pandemic, which it was, but because of what it has all the hallmarks of everything that's happening today, as well as what happened before that, which was the clip I showed you to start, the 1976 swine flu fake pandemic. It's amazing how many times we can go through this, and yet we still get screamed down by the mainstream media and the blue check sycophants on Twitter telling you that they know because they were told by the people that you're supposed to listen to. It's about time we start realizing as grown-ups that we should be thinking for ourselves. I know it's crazy, but let's start today with specifically a conversation about, I don't even know how you would properly say this, interestingly how the correlate, the mortality timeline, or actually let me adjust this window as I'm noticing, but the mortality timeline, or rather the way that mortality progresses within the COVID-19 discussion is apparently right in line with natural mortality. That's exactly the statement from Swiss Policy Research, but I will go through this and show you, there we go, why they're saying that and why that's very important. I was adjusting the screen there for you so it was lined up. But this is Swiss Policy Research to open the show today. Why COVID-19 is a strange pandemic. This graph being what we're going to talk about. Now, I find this graph to be oddly, it's clear when you understand, but the lines and the way they describe them, I find it to be confusing. One's supposed to be a solid line. Somebody point out to me where that's supposed to be. And then there's a dotted line, then there's a red and there's a blue. So you see what I mean? But anyway, the numbers are very clear, and I'll show you the point. I'm just laughing at how these things are oddly, they very basic stuff. There's four different lines, and they have to make it more complicated than it is. Now, this is September 3rd. So it says, why does COVID-19 appear to be somewhat strange pandemic? It is because of the COVID-19 mortality profile. That's the term I was looking for. Mortality profile, which is almost identical to natural mortality. So before we even take another step, if we're talking about anything that has the same, and it says almost identical to the natural mortality, and sure, that doesn't mean that, what they'll go on to point out, that doesn't mean it's not affecting you and it doesn't increase your chances of death and so on. But overall, statistically speaking, it's almost identical to natural mortality, meaning that usually people are pretty much dying where they would have. Statistically speaking, that doesn't mean that's the case, you understand. But this is incredible. And this is one more thing adding on to the larger picture that you begin to see how these people are doing gymnastics to bending over in every direction to make this into this pandemic that's dangerous when it's at every turn. You're going, is it though? How is it though? Natural mortality? You know, it's like, and so maybe there's an explanation for why, yes, that's the case, but here's why it's dangerous. Maybe in one of these cases, you could understand that. But in every single point we look at, that's what we're dealing with. Where the average person looks and goes, that doesn't seem very dangerous. And they go, whoa, let me explain why it's very dangerous. Okay. So at some level, maybe you could understand, you know, believe that they're just that much smarter than everybody and they have to walk us through why these very, you know, on their face, not very dangerous things are actually quite dangerous. I mean, I'm kind of being facetious, but you get the point. There's all these different aspects that come to the same point here. Now, it says to better understand this crucial point, we first look at two other well-known pandemics. And this is the interesting part right off the bat. The 2009 swine flu fake pandemic. Remember, this is not hypothetical. We know this now. I mean, they'll still quibble about different points about why it really was this and it really, you know, but the bottom line, it did not end up being even remotely close to what they said it was. Not that it was going to be, but that it was. So they were incorrect. No matter how you cut and slice this, they were wrong about what happened in 2009, just like they were wrong about what happened in 1976. So just remember that that's a reason you have every right to be like, maybe they're wrong this time. Or maybe they're knowingly misleading us again this time. That's how I would see it, but, you know, think for yourself. Then it says, and the notorious 1918 Spanish flu pandemic in quotes. Why? Because it's not actually the Spanish flu. It started in Kansas. This is common knowledge if you're actually somebody who thinks for themselves. And I don't mean that as a fringe conspiracy point. You can look it up on Wikipedia. The point is that the media will still toe this idea, this line, that this is just a... I mean, there's a lot of ways that goes, but the one thing they don't want you to think about is that it started in the United States and it started with the military, like every other one we find out after the fact. Find that interesting too. But the point is, remember, this. I'm going to make a couple points on this document, but going forward, remember that even Swiss Policy Research is very adamant and clear about the fact that it's a fake pandemic. And yet they have it in quotes, but you'll see why, because they're describing it in the next part. It says the 2009 swine flu was a, quote, fake pandemic. And I want to point out here too, that the idea of a, quote, fake pandemic is, like, unacceptable today. Like, you can't even hint at the idea that there was ever something like that. But recognize, just do a quick Google trend search. The idea of a, quote, fake pandemic in this sense was used quite frequently in the past. And it doesn't actually imply, or it can, but in this case doesn't imply that it was an intentionally fake pandemic. It just means that it turned out to be what they call a fake pandemic, where, you know, you could even argue they did what they were supposed to. They were trying to be safe and protect everything, and it just turned out to not be what they thought it was. But think about how funny it is in today. You're not even allowed to think like that. You're not allowed to give them the benefit of the doubt and say, well, maybe they're wrong, but they're doing the right thing. Nope, can't even say that. You cannot argue or even discuss the idea, which is why this video is probably already censored on YouTube. Every day, it's like an hour later, my videos are gone, and I'm pointing to official sources. But remember, fake pandemic. 2009 swine flu was a fake pandemic because, in reality, it was a rather mild flu that caused few deaths globally. Please recognize the correlation and the things that relate to where we are now. The idea that they told everybody this was a huge pandemic. They called it a pandemic in 2009. Everybody was afraid. People that were listening to them. They pushed vaccinations. In some cases, made them mandatory in certain ways for certain people. It wasn't real. Why can't we consider that with where we are now? You could even argue these people thought they were doing the right thing, just like the epidemic that wasn't, as well as the pandemic that wasn't, a different story we're going to get into in a minute. Two different incidences of things that didn't pan out. Why can't we ask if that's happening now? It doesn't necessarily have to mean that they're doing it intentionally. Do I believe there's an intentional line here? Absolutely. But we should be able to ask openly whether or not they've made another mistake, just like they have many times in the past. But today, you're not allowed to. It was labeled a pandemic in June 2009. The timeline will be important here, only because the WHO had removed the requirement of, quote, enormous numbers of deaths and illness 1 month before. Ah, I see. So they altered the definition of what pandemic was, removing the most important part, enormous numbers of death and illness. So just now, if it just simply spreads, well, now we've got a pandemic on our hands and now we can sell vaccines. And now, that's my opinion. Excuse me. Clearly, we can see how that does happen, though. The pandemic warning then triggered a multi-billion dollar sale of rather useless and partially dangerous vaccines. Oh, and there it is. Yep. Rather useless and partially dangerous. That's a fact. Not that because Swiss Policy Research says it, but because it is, because it happened, and it's easy to look up. So why would we be trusting it now? Because the argument is they successfully handled this. That's what you'll hear from government, as well as the fact that they did all the right things and were doing what they were supposed to. So if that's what it's supposed to look like, I just can't get past how this connects to where we are now. Now, going forward, it says, in contrast, the morality profile of the COVID-19 coronavirus is essentially zero for children. Yeah, like I've been telling you, and younger and young adults. So if it's zero, which basically it boils down to like 0.0001, however many zeros are on there, it basically comes down to zero. On the CDC website, it says zero for children. And yet we're forcing them to wear masks. We're forcing them to social distance. We're forcing them to lock down. Why? We're destroying their lives based on a zero chance because of the hypothetical argument that maybe they're asymptomatic, despite the fact that a 10 million person or over 9 million person study showed that there was zero occurrence of asymptomatic cases. Doesn't mean it doesn't exist. Just means that it's very rare. By the way, exactly what the WHO said months ago. But based on that, we're going to lock everyone down everywhere and change everyone's lives. Let that sink in. But it also says, and young adults. So not just children, but young adults. And near zero below 50. So think about this for a minute. If it's zero for children, zero for young adults, near zero below 50, what in the hell is happening right now? Before it begins to rise slowly, it says, and then very steeply after 70, and especially above 80, which, by the way, correlates with, again, natural mortality, as well as where these people are and what they're being given, such as in nursing homes and flu vaccinations and so on. We all see the picture. The point is, we have to recognize how the government is abusing the willing trust of authority and the ignorance of deeper topics of a large portion of people in this country and the world, for that matter. I mean, look, to be honest, that's not to say that people are unintelligent because they don't know these things. Understand, there's a lot of stuff that I was unaware of and didn't know as deep as I do now before all this started. Plenty of things. But the point is not that we need to say we know everything all the time, but the fact is we need to know that we have the responsibility ourselves to educate ourselves, to learn these things and not just blindly take what a person in a white coat says. Zero children, zero young adults, near zero below 50. But we're in a pandemic, though. Everybody hide and be afraid. Thus, the COVID-19 mortality profile is almost identical to natural mortality. right? I'm confused on why that means that we should still be a concern. But it says, it follows it up by saying, and I argue this kind of stuff goes in because this is how you still get funding and are able to be published, despite the fact that this is probably already being disparaged in mainstream circles. This doesn't mean that COVID-19 doesn't increase someone's death risk, or risk of death, excuse me. It absolutely does, they say. But this increase, this is what I find fascinating, but this increase is proportional to the pre-existing risk of death of the respective age and risk group. So let me understand this correctly. So they're claiming it does increase your risk of death, but that risk of death is proportional to your current risk of already dying because of your age and current risks. That's what that says. That doesn't sound like something I should be concerned about, other than just being concerned about your natural potential of possibly dying. Am I reading this incorrectly? Please, anybody, let me know. It says the characteristics of COVID-19, and again, this doesn't mean we have to blindly listen to what they say on this, but this is one more thing to add to your greater picture instead of blindly listening to one group. The characteristics of COVID-19 may have to do with the cardiovascular and immunological effects of the virus, and they explain the high death rate in nursing homes. This is what's so interesting. Remember, we just pointed out that below 50, you basically have near zero to zero chance. Then it rises slowly, but then steeply after 70 and especially after 80, right? And it's extremely high in nursing homes. So keeping that in your mind, it says, where were we right here? It says that they explain the high death rate in nursing homes. 70% of the deaths for COVID-19, Swiss Policy Research is saying, is from nursing homes. We already talked about this in the past. And people above 70, which is about 90%. So if 90% of the deaths are happening above 70, 70% of those are in nursing homes. And under 50, you have a basically zero chance of dying. Can somebody show me where the risk is here? I argue the flu is more dangerous than the way that they're describing that right now. Yes, but I'm a non-science person on YouTube. So you know what? Think for yourself, which is the whole point, guys. It just blows my mind. It says, in contrast, COVID death rates in Africa, and I find this very telling, predicted by many, including Bill Gates, to be high, have been very low. Which is, here's an interesting point or moment to point out the fact that is the case, that the one of the most high-risk areas that, historically speaking, is the place that gets the most affected has been basically unscathed in comparison to other places. But also consider the fact that why haven't the homeless population been affected? In fact, it seems odd that it's been almost zero, like in general comparison. Like you ask any place, it's basically they're not really affected. How does that make sense? When you're not really washing in a general sense, you're living outdoors in a general sense, and you're, you know, the basic sanitation is less than most people. Let's say it like that. And yet they're not affected? There's obviously something we're not being told here. It says if COVID-19 had hit us in the 50s, this is really odd, with a much younger population, few nursing homes, and a much lower prevalence of cardiovascular disease, it would have caused few deaths. So you know what that says? The issue is not the virus, it's us. Right? Because the point they're saying there is that if a virus is deadly and pathogenic and it's, you know, a pandemic kind of thing they're talking about, it wouldn't matter whether you've got nursing homes or whether you're healthy or whatever, the virus would hurt and kill people because that's what it does. But this is saying because we're unhealthy, because we shove people in nursing homes and don't care about their health, because of our prevalence of cardiovascular disease, which I argue comes from a lot more, not naturally occurring, the heart disease, whether we're talking about weight or we're talking about, you know, industrial disease, these are all things that are happening because of the malfeasance of our government to a large degree. But you remove those things, and suddenly, as they're arguing, it probably would have caused very few deaths. That tells me that it is us. And that makes me question the whole damn thing. Because of the COVID-19 mortality profile, again, being, as it says, pretty close to exactly the normal mortality profile, mass PCR testing and contact tracing in general in the general population make little sense and create an additional case-demic on top of the pandemic. Like, it's incredible we're at a point where these respectable, as we're told, you know, the ones that they would use if it was otherwise saying something else, outlets of the, I mean, it's like, whether we're talking about Swiss Policy Research or the British Medical Journal, they're the ones saying it's a case-demic. Well, you can tweet about a case-demic and they'll call you a fake news conspiracy theorist. People have lost it. We're in a really alarming state right now where we're staring at science and actual, I mean, remember how this began. Remember how it was, oh, the fringe anti-science weirdos with their one doctor. Like, whether it was Buttar or Mikovits, right? They're the crazy corner over there. We are so far past that now, with mountains of experts and medical professionals and doctor, I mean, you name it. On and on and on, entire countries are coming out and saying, this PCR test shouldn't be used, or this whole thing isn't really there, or I mean, on and on and on. And still, they want to pretend like it's a fringe conspiracy theory. I feel really bad for the mainstream media, to be honest, because it probably feels really stupid to sit there and act like what they can clearly see isn't happening. Or they're just too dumb to know. Probably both. But it says mass vaccinations will also make rather little sense, especially because at the time experimental vaccines might become available, and remember, they are experimental despite what the mainstream talking heads try to bleed at you because they were told to by their masters, it very much is an experimental vaccine. And it says, because at the time it becomes available, many people will have already been exposed to the wild virus. But it's not about anything other than giving you this thing that they're trying to test. That's my take, based on the facts. But it finishes saying, the following chart compares the very different mortality profiles of COVID-19 and the 1918 flu. Note that even in the 85-plus age group, COVID-19 lethality doesn't reach the value of the 1918 flu. As the chart uses two different scales, left versus right, and the COVID scale is four times smaller. So realize on the left, we're talking about the top says 2,500 deaths per 100,000. On the right is the 600 per 100,000. So the dark blue correlates to the left, the light blue correlates to the right. You can clearly see two things I want to show you here. First of all, like they're pointing out, that compared to the 1918 pneumonia and flu deaths, right? By the way, again, of course, they're including pneumonia then, because the point is that it's probably by and large bacterial pneumonia that's caused by masks and other things and other situations around the world, which other doctors are already pointing out, and that got lumped in with that. That's probably what's happening now, if not all, as far as I'm concerned. But recognize that even with that included, it's not even close, not even at the highest risk level. But the other point that I want you to see is look at where the death is for the light blue. This is COVID-19 deaths. Take a peek at what it looks like below this, right? This little tiny blue dot right here. This is what I'd say. I'm just going to guess and say, let's just give it under 100 based on this being 500 right there, right? So this one is what I'm talking about, the 45 to 54. If that in 100,000 people, under 100, 55 to 64, same thing, probably 200. We're talking about minimal. And in regard to the flu, it's less. Based on this information. And don't forget, this comes from the CDC. But YouTube will happily censor it because they don't like what I'm saying. Just incredible. But this is the reality, guys. Now, I want you to remember the H1N1, the discussions we had here about the fake pandemics and all the information that was laid out, because it's going to correlate throughout the entire thing. Before I move on to the pandemics and epidemics that weren't, I want to make sure we understand this point. Now, here is the actual, this is from USA Facts, and I'll go into this in a minute, but this is a tweet. But as always, I just want people to understand that I don't just look at tweets and share them. I make sure, I'm not going to share something without doing my due diligence. Doesn't mean I'm always correct, but it means that I wouldn't just see this and go, yeah, that's right, share it. I'm going to research it. I'm going to make sure those are all correct. Now, the point is, what he's saying here, despite the virus, U.S. deaths this year are literally no worse than they've been for the last 10 years and may even be on track to go down. Now, I don't think that's going to happen. Especially because ultimately I'd argue that they control the number that, you know, that gets presented. But at the same time, if that's the case, which I'll show you that it basically is, it doesn't matter how you slice the internal numbers and say, but look, here's a spike for this thing or a spike over here. At the end of the day, unless there was a dramatic decrease in something, which would arguably not make sense, it does not add up that this would be the same. But here's what somebody has to say before I show you the next point. And this is what people are doing. This is called equivocation. First of all, recognize that it's beyond a shadow of a doubt across the board. The pandemic or the lockdowns are causing an exponential increase in death in a lot of different ways. And just because this popped into my head, I'll show it now, but I'm also going to show it again at the end. Excuse me. Where was it? Oh, see, I'm going to lose it now. Right here. There we go. No, this one. No, dang it. Oh, well, now I can't find it. I had a clip of something that was, oh, well. I'm going to go back so I don't keep exposing what I'm talking about. It was, it doesn't matter. I don't want to try to explain it and then have to find it again. But the point is, guys, as we're looking at the numbers, I want to go over what this guy's saying. All over the county, people are living more safely. Anyway, to finish my point is that the lockdowns are causing an increase in death. That's absolutely true. Does that mean it's not in some decreasing in some other ways? No, it doesn't mean that. But it absolutely is increasing more than it's stopping. It says all over the country, people are living more safely. They drive less. They don't go on vacation. They're being more difficult with cleanliness, more diligent, excuse me. Car crashes are way, way down. Coronavirus is more than making up the difference. I disagree with that completely. And I think clearly Twitter doesn't seem to agree either. But nonetheless, again, my point, what is he saying here? How does that play into this? He's equivocating. If the numbers are not more than they were last year, how does that make sense? And here's the point of what he's saying. It says in 2018, the most recent year with official death estimates was basically 2,900,000, shy about 60,000. That's how many Americans died in 2018, according to our official stats. In 2019, 2,852,590 people died, which, if you're being exact, it's an increase of, it looks like 20,000 or so, which that's the point. If you go through these past numbers or go back 10 years or so, you'll see fluctuations from 30 to, a good amount over the years because of an increase in population and who knows any number of just general things. So when you see an increase of 100,000, maybe, but at the end of the day, you could argue that could just be a natural progression, but you jump to so that's 2018-19. Now it says 2,926,128 people have died from all causes between January 1st and November 28th of this year. Right? So, and basically the point is you can see how this aligns. If it's 2.9 million and that goes to 2.3 million, you can see that over the years, that's not that crazy. So the point being that we're not seeing the kind of increase that they would argue. Now, that does not mean that there's not something happening, but it does mean that I think we're being gamed here in regard to the larger picture. But this is just one small point in the larger discussion, which brings us to something that I've showed a few times that I want to start off and read just a couple points before we jump into the next one, which is called The Pandemic That Wasn't. Also an older article, but I haven't read it yet. And you'll be just amazed at how obviously this shows us an escalate that this is not new. Not only is it not new, but it's continued to happen and they continue to kick the can down the road, just like with the voting machine manipulations and everything else. Every single time it happens and every single time they use it again. This is from the New York Times. For a lot of you that watch this show regularly, you've already seen this, but I'll make this part quick. The faith in quick tests leads to epidemic that wasn't. And yes, they're talking about the PCR test. I'll jump right here just to start off with that. They're talking about the PCR test. This is what was used. It says Dr. Brooke Herndon, an internist at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center, could not stop coughing. Before long, Dr. Catherine Kirkland, an infectious disease specialist at Dartmouth, so you'd argue an expert, right? Had a chilling thought. Could she be seeing the start of whooping cough epidemic? Now, you could argue at this point, erring on the side of caution, right? You don't want to ignore it because it could be. So you can argue that this person and everybody in this whole process was simply doing what they thought was right, and it still led to a fake epidemic. Says it was the start of a bizarre episode at the medical center, as they called themselves, the story of the epidemic that wasn't. For months, nearly everyone involved thought the medical center had a huge whooping cough outbreak with extensive ramifications. By the way, none of this happened. Nearly 1,000 healthcare workers at the hospital in Lebanon, New Hampshire, were given a preliminary test, this is in the United States, and furloughed from work until their results were in. All while not a single case, well, yeah, I'm going to jump on the point. 142 people, including Dr. Herndon, were told they appeared to have the disease, and thousands were given antibiotics and a vaccine for protection. Hospital beds were taken out of commission, including some intensive care. Think about how that relates to where we are now. All these actions being taken. People think the actions being taken mean that it has to be real. Then, about 8 months later, 8 months of action, of antibiotics, of vaccines, of hospitals, of beds being manipulated, on and on, quarantines, all kinds of things. 8 months later, healthcare workers were dumbfounded to receive an email from their hospital saying that the whole thing was a false alarm. 8 months. Think about how relevant that is to where we are now. Not a single case of whooping cough, not one case was confirmed with the definitive test. not the PCR test, but the definitive test, which is what arguably we should be doing now, growing the bacterium, pertussis, which is whooping cough, in the laboratory. Instead, it appears the healthcare workers probably were afflicted with the ordinary respiratory diseases, like the common cold, which, by the way, is a coronavirus. Now, as they look back on the episode, epidemiologists and infectious disease specialists say the problem was that they placed too much faith in a quick and highly sensitive molecular test that led them astray. This is something that they acknowledged and discussed and had panels on in 2007, and yet we're pretending like this is fake news right now? I mean, it's just incredible the kind of willful ignorance we're seeing today. They use the PCR test, and they believe that is the sole reason they were led astray in believing they had a pandemic, or rather in this case, an epidemic, that didn't even happen. It says infectious, and the point being that all these people arguably were just doing what they thought was right. Right? It wasn't some massive conspiracy, or, I mean, it could be, but the point is, let's just pretend it's not. It wasn't some massive conspiracy. People were simply doing what they thought they were seeing, and the test was being led astray. It was saying it was there, but it wasn't. They saw a cough, they said, well, the test said so, so it must be. And then they moved forward on the assumption. So if they see a cough, they think probably whooping cough. That's what's happening now. We got bacterial pneumonia floating around because of masks and other things. We've got natural flu and natural pneumonia that they're combining with COVID-19. And we have a test that's increasing false positives for those and things that aren't even there. And we deem those asymptomatic. This is a perfect recipe for an illusion of exactly like this, but on a grander scale. It says infectious disease experts say such tests are coming into increasing use. Yeah, we're seeing that now. They knew this back then, they acknowledged it back then, and they let it happen. And may be the only way to get a quick answer in diagnosing diseases like whooping cough, Legionnaire's, bird flu, tuberculosis, and SARS, and deciding whether an epidemic is underway. But you cannot rely solely on that thing. That's the point. That's what every expert is saying right now, because that does not show you what's really happening. You cannot trace you cannot continue to find these out and find the different strains and trace them back. You can't. All you get is a yes or no. Why would they not want us to trace back the different strains and find out where they came from? Well, that's a good question. There is no national data on pseudo epidemics caused by an over-reliance on such tests. Why would there no data on this thing that's happened more than once? Probably because I think this is something they recognized that was quite useful. That's my opinion. There's no current data on pseudo epidemics, a very real thing that we act like doesn't count. It's fake news today. On over-reliance on things like PCR tests, according to Dr. Trish M. Pearl, an epidemiologist at, guess what, Johns Hopkins. But that's fake news. But wait a minute, Johns Hopkins said it. Uh-oh. And past president of the Society of Healthcare Epidemiologists of America. But she said pseudo-epidemics happen all the time. Let that sink in. Happens all the time, but now it's fake news today. The Dartmouth case may have been the one of the largest, but it was by no means an exception. Apparently, there was a similar whooping cough scare at Children's Hospital in Boston last fall that involved 36 adults and 2 children. Definitive tests, though, did not find pertussis. Quote, it's a problem. We know it's a problem. My guess is that what happened to Dartmouth is going to become more common. Well, Dr. Pearl, you're more right than you realize. They were calling it. They knew it. They pointed to exactly what it was. And yet here we are using the PCR test again. Which brings us to the pandemic that wasn't, specifically about H1N1. You know that thing that we're all being told is a model for where we are now? Of course. This is March 11th, 2010. 2009 was the pandemic. That wasn't, because it wasn't a pandemic. And understand, guys, before we go forward, this is the case. We know this now. The numbers weren't there. They can keep calling it a pandemic all they want. It simply didn't happen. The numbers were not there. They did not prove. They didn't even come close to showing what they said was happening was actually happening. And here is even mainstream media pointing to it and saying, not only was this wrong, but you guys failed in spectacular fashion. And there was entire groups that called this out and tried to change everything, which we'll get to next. But guess what they didn't do? Change everything. It went on to keep going exactly like it did before. So you have to ask yourself why, if they see this, whether it's government entities, international entities, that they saw this along the way decades ago and just continued to let it grow. Why would that be? It says the H1N1 swine flu, actually, I'll start off with Henry L. Miller, or is it I, is, as it says in here, a physician, molecular biologist, and former flu researcher. fellow at Stanford University, Hoover Institution, and Competitive Enterprise Institute. He was official at the National Institute of Health and the FDA. Not, I would say, definitely an insider. I would argue today, though, based on his Twitter feed, that he wouldn't be writing this article today. So that makes it even more relevant to me. Here's what it says on his Wikipedia page. He's an American medical researcher and a columnist. And I'm just reading this for you so to give more credence to his opinion. Whether or not he doesn't want to express that opinion today for whatever reason. Formerly with the FDA, and from 1994 until 2008, the Robert Wesson Fellow in Science, Philosophy, and Public Policy at Stanford University's Hoover Institution, a public policy think tank located on the university's campus in California. He's an adjunct fellow of the Competitive Enterprise Institute. He was educated at MIT, via a bachelor's in life science and the University of California, San Diego, and he's he was a resident at clinical fellow in medicine and clinical fellow in medicine at Harvard's Beth Israel Hospital in Boston. He performed research on gene organization and expression as a research fellow in the laboratory of Philip Leder, MD, at the NIH. Philip Leder is something, it's a name you might remember. He was the medical reviewer for the first genetically engineered drugs to be evaluated by the FDA and was instrumental, they say, in the rapid licensing of genetically engineered human insulin and human growth hormone. So arguably someone that's well aware of the ins and outs of what they're doing. So I just find that quite relevant. Now, going back, he says, the H1N1 swine flu outbreak appears to have ended less like the rogue wild boar that United Nations bureaucrats predicted and more like roasted pork tenderloin with apples and sage. From the beginning of World Health Organization's actions, the World Health Organization's actions have ranged from the dubious to the flagrantly incompetent. Remember, this is 10 years ago. That group that is still guiding policy today and without even question, according to the mainstream media. And ironically, it says, one might even consider the emergence of the H1N1 flu during the past year a net public health benefit, since it appears to have suppressed, get this, or at least supplanted the far more virulent and lethal seasonal flu strains. Ah, okay. So now we're looking back 10 years ago and finding out during the H1N1 non-pandemic that also, weirdly enough, flu deaths and everything else just dropped off the map. I wonder why that would be. Maybe because they were conflating flu with H1N1 to make it seem like it was more severe. I mean, this is ridiculous. The only reason these things are not being widely spread is because there's people blindly trusting mainstream media and because the social engineers are making sure this does not get out. Unless you're watching our shows, unless you're listening to independent media, you won't even know this exists. The idea that they're combining these things, which should not even be happening, even though it's publicly stated on their website. You will never hear the media tell you that. During the second week of January, and we're talking about 2009, 3.7% of Americans tested positive for the seasonal flu, compared with 11.5% during the same week last year. The death toll in the U.S. from H1N1 is estimated by the CDC to be around 3,900, while in an average year, seasonal flu kills about 36,000. But even that, by the way, is combining pneumonia with the flu, which is also manipulated, but we're on a whole other game at this point. So just like we're seeing now, where flu just apparently has been cured, flu is gone, hooray, pneumonia is gone, hooray. No, it's all clearly there, and it's being labeled COVID-19. But we saw the exact same thing with H1N1. Seems like they were just getting their game down. They're getting their, you know, whatever you would call it, their shtick, getting it all organized and trying and then trying again. It says the WHO's April 2009 decision to raise the pandemic flu threat to the penultimate level, phase five, pandemic imminent, was unwarranted, he says, and far outpaced the data accumulated. It's just incredible that this is being stated as absolute fact in the mainstream media. Even worse was the June declaration that a pandemic was underway, which exposed the WHO's flawed fundamental paradigm, a warning system based solely on how widely a virus has spread, but does not consider the nature, severity, and impact of the illness it causes, is prone to false positives. Oh, look at that. Prone to false positives. Weird. It's like that thing that doesn't exist today, that according to the mainstream media, it's all fake news. The point is, we're not talking about PCRs in this case, but we're still talking about the idea of an illusion being built. And you realize what he's saying there. The warning system, not based on severity and impact, that's because they removed that part, just like they pointed out before. They removed the concept. That's what they point out in here. Remember, they chose to remove deaths and severity. So the only thing you need is something that's spreading and in lots of places. That's the point. Let me read it again. A warning system based solely on how widely a virus is spread, but does not consider the nature, severity, and impact, is prone to false positives. You don't say. That's exactly where we are right now. It would classify not only seasonal flu, but also the frequent but largely inconsequential outbreaks of virus-caused colds and gastroenteritis as pandemics. Yeah, exactly. This guy in Forbes is literally stating exactly what we're talking about today, that we are being shouted down as absolute maniacs for bringing up. Do you not realize how crazy that is? He's telling you that because of the way that they altered the definition of what they're claiming is a pandemic, now it's going to sweep up all kinds of colds and different things that are claimed to be pandemics because it's just happening in the same location as what they're telling you is a massive pandemic. We all see that happening. Suddenly there's no flu. Suddenly no one cares about anything but COVID-19. Suddenly anybody anywhere that has the sniffles is a COVID-19 case. That's what's happening right now. It says the WHO has never offered any explanation for why these examples that seem to fit its definition of a pandemic do not meet its criteria. The point being, not that these things should be pandemics, but that because they've altered the definition of a pandemic to fit what they want you to think is a pandemic, their question is, why aren't these other things that are arguably worse not also called pandemics? Because they're gaming information and manipulating your perception. The point is, if that is, so are a lot of other things that we don't even care about usually every year. But it's not. That's the point. It says the UN's false alarms have had more immediate negative effects. Matthew Hingerty, managing director of Australia's Tourism Export Control, lamented the country lost thousands of tourists because of the WHO's pandemic declaration. Now realize what that's telling you guys. This is saying they know about the economic repercussions of doing what they're doing. They know that. They've seen it in numerous cases that when they do these things, they have an obvious effect on economic prosperity, on individual lives, and they don't care today. They act like, we never thought about planes flying into buildings, you know, the old game. Of course they did, because they gamed it out before 9/11, just like this. They know that these actions will cause the things that are causing, but they're acting like they're dumbfounded right now because, as I keep telling you, they would always rather be incompetent or seen as incompetent than be seen as the criminals that they are right now. Because if they can pretend like, oopsie, I was only doing what I thought was right, even if it's killing people, they can pretend like they did the best they could. But when you find out that they knew this would happen and did it anyway, well, that's called a crime. That's called, like, unbelievable government malfeasance. Managing director of Australia's Tourism Export Control was talking about H1N1 and how their actions based on a false pandemic lost thousands of tourists in their area. It says Egyptian public health authorities, here's another interesting part, overreacted based on the lies or misinformation from their governments and their international entities, and summarily ordered the slaughter of all the pigs in the country. We've seen that happen numerous times based on incorrect information. In addition to the devastating economic losses, garbage filled the streets of Cairo, and the numbers of rodents rose to fearsome levels, which I guarantee caused an increase in illness, because the pigs were no longer available to consume much of the garbage produced in the city. Now, that may sound weird to people that live in different places, but the point is that's how that works there. And because of that action, it actually increased the rats and the garbage and the increased illness. It says the UN indicted by the law of unintended consequences. It's capitalized. Hope you see that. Meaning this is not a new concept. This is something that has been discussed, that has been acknowledged, but they did it anyway. And that all they can do is say COVID-19 is why you don't have a job. COVID-19 is why you can't feed your family. No. It's called the law of, in this case, ignored consequences. The publicity and resulting panic surrounding the WHO's announcement of phase 5 and 6 alerts, especially since the vaccine was not widely available until December. Does that sound familiar at all? Also brought out the fraudulent peddling of all sorts of ineffective and possibly dangerous protective gear. Now listen to this statement, guys. I want you to understand this was 10 years ago. He's saying potentially dangerous and ineffective protective gear. What do you think he's about to list off? Take a listen. Especially since the vaccine was not widely available, it also brought out the fraudulent peddling of all sorts of ineffective, possibly dangerous protective gear and nostrums, which is another term which essentially just means medicine in a, prescribed by an unqualified person, including gloves, masks, dietary supplements, shampoo, a nasal sanitizer, and a spray that supposedly coats the hands with a layer of antimicrobial iconic silver. Here's a mainstream author in 2011 claiming that masks and gloves and dietary supplements and shampoos at this time were possibly dangerous but ineffective. Do you think that he was overrun with scathing rebukes and saying, how dare you say masks don't work, because we all know they do, it's common sense? No, that didn't happen. You know why? Because that wasn't common sense at the time. The idea that masks were there to stop viruses was ineffective and possibly dangerous. And he knew that because that was generally the common sense. The point is that they've changed you. They've changed definitions of things. They've changed the way we talk about things to suit their agenda. I find it absolutely baffling that he can write that as such a statement of matter of fact, and nobody calls him out. Nobody has an issue with it. Until now, I start pointing to it. Now, how much you want to bet this article gets removed? The point is that this was a fact and was information that they were generally aware of. And now, because we're going to argue they did some kind of rapid systemic review of things in the middle of the pandemic and paid people to look at only certain things, that they suddenly decided masks were useful for viruses in the middle of this after all the years of never doing. I mean, it's absurd. By the way, as always, guys, I have all of the links. I'll just go to the main page so you can see it. In every article that I show you these days, every single one of them, this is where the links will be when I'm done with the show. I'll add them. And I always change out the YouTube one for the uploaded one. But all these are studies of masks. All five of these are studies that show you. They all find verifiable health effects from wearing a mask, including scientifically verified reduction in blood oxygen level. All of them are from PubMed, from NIH, and the National Library of Medicine. Every single one of them find the same. But that's all fake news, though, if you listen to the mainstream media. Cloth masks. This one shows you clearly that cloth masks increase the risk of bacterial infection. That's exactly what they find from the NIH, the National Library of Medicine. I've not seen a single study after this even trying to challenge it or finding it. Nothing. That is the random controlled trial that was done, and nobody wants to point to it. Because everybody's using cloth masks, and that's increasing the risk of bacterial infection. And I argue increasing the risk and the spread of bacterial pneumonia, which, by the way, is contagious. You can see how this could continue to build and spread. And we say COVID-19 and nobody thinks twice. All of these are masks on the efficacy of studies on the efficacy of masks. Some of these say half and half. Some of them say some work, some don't. The point is to read everything and understand that by and large, all the random controlled trials tell you the same thing. Masks do not have a statistically significant difference on transmission, period. Every time. But going back to the pandemic that wasn't, excuse me, this is telling you, as far as he's concerned, that that's the case. Now, going forward, WHO's performance has been widely criticized. Most flu experts, here's what I find interesting, remember this part, he says most flu experts, because they're going to say the exact opposite in another article about today, most flu experts believe that the WHO's actions were overly alarmist and precipitous, and the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe announced that it plans to debate false pandemics, a threat to health. Now, we're going to talk about that next. Remember that. Because this was a very real thing and a very big thing that apparently that changed nothing, but shows you that there's a lot of people out there that see this as a problem. Sort of, again, remember that we're talking about back then in 2007, where they're saying, yeah, we know this happens all the time. I shouldn't say all the time. We know this is a problem that has happened, is continuing to happen, and is going to increase the more they use these tests. Now it says, and yet WHO officials continue to defend their actions. Most flu experts believe they were wrong, according to this author and mainstream article on Forbes. But, and remember, guys, looking back, we know that they were wrong, right? We're looking back with history behind us, and we know that they were mistaken. But at the time, in 2011, the WHO still refused to admit that they were wrong. Please understand why that's important to where we are now. And yet WHO officials, it says, continue to defend their actions in 2011. In a January 14th conference call with reporters, Keiji Fukuda, which, by the way, you'll see referenced in every single one of these articles back then discussing why this is not the case or why everything was correct and blah, blah, blah. That's my point in telling you that is you'll always find the same person being repeated. They don't all have their different experts all coming to independent conclusions that all say it was right and safe. No, they parrot the one guy who's willing to stand up and say that. That's usually what happens in the mainstream media. But it says in that conference call in January 14th, he's a special advisor to the WHO's director general for pandemic flu. He remonstrated that the organization had not overplayed the danger, but, quote, prepared for the worst and hoped for the best. Well, sure, that's really nice to say, except for the fact that those alarmist claims that were based on not actual factual information caused economic problems, caused an increase in vaccine sales. So just because you want to act like you're preparing for the worst and hoping for the best, that doesn't fly because you have to be held accountable for the actions, especially when you realize, as we're going to get into shortly, that there is obvious conflicts of interest, that there are obvious cases of these kind of people having ties to the pharmaceutical companies. It says, quote, the world is going through a real pandemic, they reassert, despite the facts, and they're wrong. We know that now. The description of it as fake is wrong and irresponsible. That sound familiar? He was wrong. He's wrong now. But he was not afraid to stand up and shout you down and tell you you're irresponsible for claiming the truth. WHO spokesman Greg Hartle, who said, quote, we cannot control how people react to the things we say. Yeah, that's real onus, right? That's really taking responsibility. So because we said you're all going to die, we can't take responsibility for how you flipped out and hurt people, right? Yeah, isn't that the whole point of logic around screaming fire in a theater? That's their premise, not mine. I argue free speech is absolute. My point is, that's what they would tell us. That, yeah, you've got limits to your free speech, except when the WHO wants to tell you you're all going to die and then not be concerned with the fallout. That's called hypocrisy. It says the WHO's dubious decisions demonstrate that its officials are too rigid or too incompetent or both to make needed adjustments in the pandemic warning system, which they didn't. Deficiencies we have come to expect from an organization that is scientifically challenged, he says, self-important and unaccountable. Well, seemingly 10 years of the same thing didn't change anything. Here we are right now with the same circumstances. The WHO may be able to perform and report worldwide surveillance, i.e. count numbers of cases and fatalities, but its policy should be drastically limited, which it wasn't. It actually increased. Now, despite what people are probably thinking in their minds who support Donald Trump, that, oh, Trump removed, that didn't happen. Understand that that was a statement made in regard. Right now, that's supposed to change going into the new year, which arguably won't matter now since it looks like Trump isn't going to be there next year. But even though he claims he stopped that funding, they gave, I think it was about four times as much money to groups like Gavi, which went through the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which then continued to fund the World Health Organization. So that was an illusion. That was a shell game of funding. At the end of the day, the U.S. government and Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation are still the leading funders of the WHO. Doesn't matter how it gets there, right? It says the WHO may be able to perform and report worldwide surveillance, but the policy should be drastically limited. It says UN bureaucrats pose as authorities on all manner of products. You're not allowed to say this stuff today. Public, on all manner of products, public policy, and human activities. From diversification and biodiversity, very relevant, to the regulation of chemicals, use of the ocean, and the testing of genetically engineered plants. All of these things affect your life and your world that you live in, and they don't care a second about how it affects you. That's my opinion. However, it says the UN's regulatory policies, requirements, and standards often defy scientific consensus and common sense. What? Right, so they're talking about the WHO. They're talking about all these things in regard to the pandemic that wasn't. They're straight up telling you that their regulatory policies and requirements often defy scientific consensus and common sense. But right now we're being told we can't even challenge what they're saying because that's the scientific consensus. Do you not realize how incredibly inverted this has all become? That my point in telling you all this today is that this is you watching the biosecurity state slowly take control over the people pointing at what it was doing. That's what you're staring at right now. Over the years, we continue to watch. Your government allowed this to happen. And now we're at a point where you can't even point at them. You can't even say, look, they're doing that, because then you're fake news and you're censored and you're attacked. Whereas this guy at this point was still able to say, hey, they're crazy and they're not listening to you and they're defying scientific consensus and common sense. And then he was probably quickly shoved away. It says officials are no friends of commerce, public health, or environmental protection. The result is a more precarious, more dangerous, and less resilient world. When it comes to pestilence, the UN may be the greatest plague of all. Well, thank you, Harry, at the time, for having the courage to say what was actually happening. But so again, this is March 11th. Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me. I think I was saying 2011 that whole time. 10, because it was 2009 is when the pandemic was. So March 11th, 2010. I apologize for the discrepancy. So all that being said, the fact that we know that this is the H1N1 swine flu was an illusion. It was the pandemic that wasn't. And they pushed vaccines and all the same things we're seeing today. And we know that in 2007, we have the same idea of an epidemic that wasn't using the PCR test and so on and so on. Well, this brings us to the fact that in December 18th, 2009, after the pandemic, we have the Parliamentary Assembly speaking out and saying this was fake. Not that it was incorrect, but it was faked with a D, as in somebody faked this pandemic. Take a note at the people involved. There are some prominent people here. One you might recognize is Wolfgang Woldgaard, who's been trying to wake you up to this reality for decades or more. But just note all the different countries: Turkey, Bulgaria, Monaco, Italy, Sweden, United Kingdom, Luxembourg. These across the world, people are coming together to call out that not just the fact that we're being deceived, but that the entire H1N1 scandal was a faked pandemic. This thing is called Faked Pandemics: A Threat for Health. Now, on December 18th is when this was put forward. It's a motion for recommendation. They put this forward saying, in order to promote their patented drugs and vaccines against flu, pharmaceutical companies, and remember, this is a prominent organization, have influenced scientists and official agencies responsible for public health standards to alarm governments worldwide. Clearly, it didn't work in H1N1. Clearly didn't have the kind of control over the minds and directions of health officials around the world. But clearly, since 2010 or 2009 to 2020, I would argue they achieved that. So because now it's happening again, but now you don't have these kind of people that are, well, you do to some degree, but the governments were, as it says here, to alarm governments worldwide. Well, they succeeded. They got them either afraid or to toe the line. And now you've got around the world people pushing this agenda. But this is what they were calling out 10 years ago. Responsible for public health standards to alarm government worldwide. It says they have made them squander tight health care resources. We all feel that right now as you can barely feed your family, but all the big companies are doing just fine. They've made them squander tight health care resources for inefficient vaccine strategies and needlessly exposed millions of healthy people to the risk of unknown side effects of insufficiently tested vaccines. Well, damn if that's not exactly where we are right now. It says the birds flu campaign 2005-2006, combined with the swine flu campaign, seemed to have caused a great deal of damage, not only to some vaccinated patients, that's important, and to public health budgets, but also to the credibility and accountability of important international health agencies. The definition of an alarming pandemic must not be under the influence of drug sellers. The member states of the Council of Europe should ask for immediate investigations on the consequences at national as well as European level. That's incredible. And I argue you probably never heard of that. Big deal. Right after that, of course, they spoke out and said, you're wrong, like they usually do. And they screamed at January 13th. So we're looking at about a little less than a month later. The title is Health Officials, Experts Reject False Pandemic Charges. But remember, we know that they're wrong, right? We have history on our side now, and we know that they were incorrect. So here they are, 6 months later, continuing to scream that you're wrong. We know it was serious, and you're trying to put people at risk. They're false, and we know they're false. H1N1 was a fake pandemic. The data's not there, but here they are continuing to toe the line. Leading public health officials and experts have sharply rejected charges from the European officials that pharmaceutical companies used exaggerated claims about the H1N1 pandemic threat to scare governments into buying unnecessary stockpiles of vaccines. Well, that's a very specific thing to disagree with. That the point is they wanted to make it sound like that's all not true. But all they disagreed with was a very specific part of what they were claiming. That pharmaceutical companies used exaggerated claims to scare governments into buying vaccines. Right? There's a whole point in there about this thing was fake, that it wasn't, that they used misleading information. No, all they're quibbling about is that the pharmaceutical companies had influence. which, by the way, we'll show you in a moment that that's been talked about for since the year 2000, even before. It says the Council of Europe, an organization of 47 nations, right? So not some little fringe internet group. 47 nations said yesterday that the charges will be on the agenda when its parliamentary assembly meets in France later this month. This is in 2010. It says the charges detailed in a proposed resolution come as the United Kingdom, France, Germany, and other countries, 47, are scaling back their vaccine. Oh, no, excuse me. That was the other one. That the United Kingdom, France, Germany, and other countries are scaling back their vaccine orders. Uh-oh. So the moment you start scaling back your vaccine orders, well, then suddenly everything has to, like, this. That's when things start being called out. The bottom line, the vaccine sales. Weak demand for the vaccine in the face of declining flu activity and the need for just one dose have left many countries with surpluses, though the public health officials warn that another wave of infections could come this winter. All this should be shockingly familiar to what we're being told right now. Oh, and don't forget, though, they made it two doses this time so they could get away with that problem. It says Dr. Wolfgang Woodarg, remember, and you've heard him, I've showed him on the show, a German physician and politician who chairs the Council of Europe's Health Committee. I believe he no longer holds that position, but it says was quoted in the British media as saying the WHO's pandemic declaration last June triggered vaccine contracts with governments and that companies reap financial benefits without taking any risks. Yeah, but that's fake news, though, right? We all can see that that's the case today. That has been wildly pointed out in 100 different ways. And they're now they're straight up telling you we've removed liability from, I mean, they have indemnity. They cannot be charged with a crime, even if it's shown that they absolutely made a mistake. Like, unless you can show that it was an intentional lapse, like they chose to make it hurt you, nothing can happen. Even if you find out that they made the most obvious mistakes and they ended up, you know, killing 100,000 people, you can't hold them accountable because you have to prove they did it on purpose, which is just next to impossible with the way our court system works today. He says he told the London Daily Mail that the pandemic H1N1 virus was, quote, a mild flu and a false pandemic. In the Council of Europe resolution, Woodarg and 13 others charged that pharmaceutical companies have made countries, quote, squander tight healthcare resources, as we pointed out before, for inefficient vaccine strategies, and needlessly exposed millions of healthy people to the risk of unknown side effects of insufficiently tested vaccines. Well, gee, that sounds relevant. The WHO... That's weird. Okay, it's right there. The WHO has said it would review its pandemic response after the pandemic is over. Isn't that great? And would field questions related to the proposed Council of Europe resolution at its executive board meeting on January 18th, which we'll show next. But the funny part is, yeah, we'll deal with this once we're done with this thing that's actually not happening. And think about how crazy it is that they probably know that. So that's a way to just kick the can down the road, which I argue really never did anything. But it says British Health Secretary Andy Burnham says, quote, I would make no apology for making all the necessary preparations to keep people safe. Right. So this is the argument that it's always in your interest. So it doesn't matter. So we'll look back 10 years from now and look at all the damage caused by lockdowns and masks and all these actions. And all they're going to do is say exactly that. I don't apologize for doing what I needed to do to make sure that. Same thing every time. Doesn't matter that we look back now and see that that wasn't true, that they weren't even in danger. The excuse will still fly in government circles. I think we have come through the pandemic because of the strength of the plans. Ah, isn't that also what we're hearing today? And the preparations that the government put in place. Nope, that's also not true. We know that now. But this is what you're hearing today. And they're going to do the same thing. Even if they know that's not true, this is what they're going to say because this is what they do. But jumping back, okay, this is December 18th when this was put forward, the motion for recommendation. Or actually, then this is the normal progression. So that was December. This is January 13th. Okay, here we are. Oh, that's why I said that. Yeah, so this is December 18th. Okay, motion for recommendation. Here's the actual document right here. Faked pandemics. And you can see a lot of, you know, there's prominent names here. People that are you're becoming to recognize as voices of truth that are continuing to tell you what they don't want you to see. But in here, you have all the information of how this all broke down. But I just want to show you on this is January 18th, 2009. Now, this is the recommendation. So that was the motion for recommendation. Here's the recommendation itself. Handling of the H1N1 pandemic, more transparency needed, which, you know, clearly didn't happen because now they're saying what they said before all this today. It was a successful pandemic. The vaccine saved lives, blah, blah, blah. Now, it says On the handling of H1N1 pandemic, more transparency is needed. The Parliamentary Assembly notes that there is an urgent need for a thorough review of recent decisions taken by public health authorities at international, European, and national level in the framework of the H1N1 influenza pandemic, given that a lack of transparency in public decisions undermines democratic principles, right? It's just basically saying we need to know what went down because we have serious doubts about how it happened. Okay, here's the actual resolution after the recommendation. It says the Parliamentary Assembly is alarmed about the way in which the H1N1 influenza pandemic has been handled, not only by the WHO, but also by the competent health authorities, both at the level of the European Union and at national level. It is particularly troubling by some of the consequences of decisions. Excuse me. It is particularly troubled. By some of the consequences of decisions taken and advice given leading to the distortion of priorities of health, public health services across Europe, the waste of large sums of public money and unjustified fears about health risks faced by European public at large, which they are correct, right? We know now they were right. The assembly notes that the grave shortcomings, have been identified regarding the transparency of decision-making processes relating to the pandemic, which have generated concerns about the possible influence of the pharmaceutical industry on some of the major decisions relating to the pandemic. Yeah, we all know that's the case. I mean, it's so abundantly clear. And all they can do is act like, that's so how dare you suggest such a thing? But it's verified. It's very clear. The pharmaceutical, the whole revolving, we just pointed out how Gottlieb just got a position on the FDA. I mean, it's in the way the revolving door scenario of our government is insulting. They work in the government and they get a cushy position on the very agency they were just supposed to regulate. It's called regulatory capture, and it's something we all need to understand. But it says, notwithstanding the willingness of WHO and European health institutions concerned to enter into dialogue and conduct a review of the handling of the pandemic, the assembly seriously regrets that they have not been willing to share some essential information. So they're just not working with them. In particular, to publish the names and declarations of interest of the members of the emergency committee and who and relevant of the WHO and relevant European advisory bodies directly involved in recommendations concerning the handling of the pandemic. Oh, I see. So they refuse to let you know who made the decisions and why. Why would that be? Actually, we'll show you next, because it turns out that it's been publicly known for a long time that there's the most disgusting crossover of conflicts of interest throughout all of these agencies. So the reason they don't want to show you this is because they'll know that those people will potentially be held accountable for their knowingly incorrect decisions. It says, furthermore, the assembly regrets that WHO has not moved swiftly to revise or reevaluate its position on the pandemic, the one that we know is not real, and the real health risks involved. Despite they're talking about the health risks from their actions they're taking, not the pandemic. Despite the overwhelming evidence that the seriousness of the pandemic was vastly overestimated by WHO at the onset. It's just incredible. In addition, the assembly regrets the highly defensive stance taken by WHO, big surprise, whether in terms of being unwilling to accept that a change in the definition of a pandemic was made, or an unwillingness to revise its prognosis on the pandemic. Pretty damn clear. Moving forward, you can see this is the resolution, by the way, got voted on and passed 60-1. One abstention. So clearly, the Parliamentary Assembly is on the same page at this time. And there's 47 countries involved here, voting all that this is clear, that they lie, that this is a deception, that it's faked pandemic, and we need more transparency. Doesn't that blow your mind? The fact that can happen and no one talks about it, and two, that we're here still, that nothing changed, and you'll see why. It just makes me sick. So here is the final document with all the information that I hope you'll read through. The handling of H1 pandemic, more transparency needed. This was June 7th, 2010. So after the WHO answered questions and after they refused to do this and pretended they did all the right things, it says grave shortcomings have been identified regarding the transparency of decision-making processes relating to the pandemic, which have generated concerns about the possible influence of the pharmaceutical industry on some of the major decisions relating to the pandemic. It must be feared that this lack of transparency and accountability will result in a plummet in confidence in the advice given by major public health institutions. Well, that's long since gone. I would argue the concern is a little bit more worrying than just not trusting your government. But to point out the main thing here at the end, clearly says, what lessons have been learned? It says, an in-depth review of the global response of the influenza pandemic began in April. An external review committee convened under the international health regulations will examine how the world and WHO responded to the pandemic H1N1. The overarching goal is to identify lessons learned and ways to improve how the world can work together to protect global health during a public health emergency. The rigorous external review of the global response to pandemic H1N1 is an unprecedented process that will influence public health decisions making during the next pandemic and in other public health emergencies of international concern. So what does that translate to? It translates to, we see how you can see, we recognized how you're able to see that we were manipulating you, so we made actions to make sure that that wouldn't be the case going forward. Whether that is more regulatory capture, more control over the media, which is probably what happened, and more control over politicians. So here's the point. Nothing changed. Nothing. We're right where we were then with all the same, I would argue with far, far, far more influence from pharmaceutical industries and, you know, international entities like this. So this is a big deal with 47 countries all voting that this was an illusion that they lied about and knowingly manipulated and nothing happened. Doesn't that sound sort of like saying, hey, these voting machines I was paid to cheat with and nothing happened and I used the same machines next time. Clint Curtis, I played it 100 times. How can you not understand what that shows you? That one, the people that are supposed to be holding these people accountable and making decisions for your best interest do not care about that and instead want to use that for their benefit at your expense. That's what that means. Blows my mind. But going back even further to the year 2000, this is a hearing in the House. I knew I'd forget it. The Federal Advisory Committee Act. It says, quote, conflicts of interest and vaccine development preserving the integrity of the process. Okay, so a hearing. Now, understand that some of these comments will be, and I apologize for the way that the screen shows it. I'm not sure why the screen capture did it like this. I believe you can still see that. But this is discussions being had in a congressional hearing. So there's a lot of things being stated, but I want you to understand is this is being discussed in this hearing specifically about conflicts of interest. And these things are being stated because they're facts. And I'll read through them and you can decide for yourself. But my point in showing you this is you go back even before the H1N1 scandal. In the year 2000, you had your Congress pointing this out and saying there are wild and obvious conflicts of interest within our process and this needs to change for the very purpose they're saying, for preserving the integrity of the process. Do you think that happened? Do you think that changed? Do you think we're now at a point where that's less than it was then? A child could see that's not true. So what I want you to continue to see throughout this is that your government, at some stage, there were people that were pointing it out, whether that was intentional for another reason or because they actually want to change. Your government allowed this to continue to grow despite the evidence, despite the obvious issue and expense of from your life. In fact, putting you at more risk. So it says, it's clear from a reading of the entire section that the provisions refer to the agency in question and particularly their ethics officials. As you know, Congress guards its rights to conduct oversight and make information public very jealously. It doesn't make any sense to suggest that Congress would pass a law that would stop it from making public information about conflicts of interest and undue influence of special interests. Right. So this is what he's discussing here is the fact that right in the beginning, they were discussing a law that would stop the Congress from being able to point out conflicts of interest or ask about them. That's incredible. As it shows you that this is them building toward creating the scenario we're in now. It says nowhere in this entire section is Congress referred to. So they're arguing that Congress isn't even mentioned in this. So they want the pharmaceutical companies, even back then, to have the ability to have conflicts of interest in regard to the government process without you even being aware of it and without Congress having the ability to talk about it. Does that sound like a... I mean, think of... That's in the year 2000. This reads, for the last few months, we've been focusing on two important advisory committees, the Food and Drug Administration and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. They rely on these advisory committees. The CDC and the FDA rely on these advisory committees to help them make vaccine policies that affect every child in America. It says, we've looked very carefully at conflicts of interest. We've taken a good, hard look at whether the pharmaceutical industry has too much influence over these committees. From the evidence we found, we believe that they do. Right. So congressional hearings. Mr. Waxman. Anyway, I looked at it earlier. I don't want to have to take 5 minutes to find his name real quick. But this is a member of Congress pointing this out in this hearing about conflicts of interest within this process. And they're saying very clearly that based on the evidence, it's clear that they do have more too much influence. This is right in the beginning of this discussion. In the year 2000, they're acknowledging the overwhelming influence of pharmaceutical industries in this process. And here we are now. I'm sure you can imagine what didn't happen. Goes on to say, families need to have confidence that the vaccines that their children take are safe, effective, and very necessary. Doctors need to feel confident that when the FDA licenses a drug, that it's really safe and that the pharmaceutical industry has not influenced the decision-making process. It says, doctors place trust in the FDA and assume that if the FDA has licensed a drug, it's safe for use. But we know that's not true, even if you want to call it just accidents. Right, that they have licensed countless drugs that turn out to be very dangerous. But it says, has that trust been violated? How confident in the safety and need of specific vaccines would doctors and parents be if they learned the following? Now, this is incredible. These are facts, guys. These are facts being listed off by this member of Congress. So if parents learn the following, would they still feel safe about vaccines? One, that members, including the chair of the FDA and CDC advisory committees, who make these decisions, own stock in drug companies that make the vaccines. Two, that individuals on both advisory committees own patents for vaccines under consideration or affected by the decisions of the committee. Three, that the three out of the five of the members of the FDA's advisory committee who voted for the rotavirus vaccine, remember this is something Mikovits talks about all the time, had conflicts of interest that were waived. Four, that seven individuals of the 15-member FDA advisory committee were not present at the meeting. Two others were excluded from the vote, and the remaining five were joined by five temporary voting members who all just so happened to vote to license the product. Five, that the CDC grants conflict of interest waivers to every member of their advisory committee a year at a time, and allows full participation in the discussions leading up to a vote by every member, whether they have a financial stake in this discussion or not, or decision or not. So they're discussing it, influencing members possibly, whether they have a financial stake or not. Right? The point being is these people that have stake in the company likely and are pushing others to make decisions when they shouldn't even be in the meeting. Sixth, that the CDC's advisory committee has no public members. No parents have a vote in whether or not the vaccine belongs on the childhood immunization schedule. The FDA's committee only has one member, one public member. Incredible. These are just a few, he says, of the problems we found. Those are incredibly obvious problems. And no, I mean, that's crazy. That's just a few of them, he says. He says, how confident can we be in the process when we learn that most of the work of the CDC advisory committee is done in, quote, working groups? Now, we've talked about this before, that meet behind closed doors, out of the public eye. Members who can't vote in the full committee because of conflicts of interest are allowed to work on the same issues in working groups. So it's basically just it's a workaround. The same people get to work there anyway, and they act like they don't because you don't know about this process. It says, and there is no public scrutiny because we don't get told about it. He says, I was appalled to learn that at least six of the 10 individuals who participated in the working group for the rotavirus vaccine, of course, had financial ties to pharmaceutical companies developing rotavirus vaccines. But yeah, they want you to believe that you shouldn't be concerned about that. That's just conspiracy theory. It says, how confident can we be in the recommendations for the FDA when the chairman and other individuals on their advisory committee own stock in major manufacturers of vaccines? These are supposed to be conspiracy questions being stated openly in a public hearing in Congress. How confident can we be in a system when the agency seems to feel that the number of experts is so few around the country that everyone has a conflict and thus waivers must be granted? We've already mentioned this as well. It almost appears that there is an old boys network of vaccine advisors that rotate between the CDC and the FDA, exactly, at times serving simultaneously. Some of these individuals served for did I miss that? Oh, it says served for more than 4 years. 4 years. It says, we found one instance where an individual served for 16 years continuously on the CDC committee. And that's not supposed to be happening. It says, with over 700,000 physicians in this country, how can one person be so indispensable that they stay on the committee for 16 years? It's important to determine if the Department of Health and Human Services has become complacent in their implementation of the legal requirements on conflicts of interest and committee management. If the law is so loose, we need to change it. But it wasn't. If the agencies aren't doing their job, they need to be held accountable. But they weren't. That's the purpose of this hearing, to try to determine what needs to be done. But nothing was. Now, I hope you'll take the time to read. Oh, there was more part here. But there's so much in here. These are just a couple of discussion points that I wanted to pick out. Now, this is him point blank asking this person. This is one of their experts who's supposed to be defending the idea of this. And he says, Mr. Glenn, yes, sir. And first he says, Mr. Burton, how many doctors did you say we had in the country? We have 700,000 physicians in America, probably a couple hundred thousand scientists as well. Now, the rotavirus, we found that many of those people that were on the advisory committee that dealt with that were on the committees year after year after year. And financial conflicts of interest and were making decisions on the vaccine, knowing full well that the company that they had stock in or had financial interest in was going to make a profit, which in turn would be beneficial to them. Mr. Glenn says, yes, sir, I understand. Mr. Burton, who is speaking, says the vaccine had not been, to our knowledge, thoroughly tested. What do you know about that? And yet they went ahead and approved it. So that's not the big issue, right? That's a stated fact. And all we're quibbling about is whether these people have too much influence in pharmaceuticals. And they knowingly put something out that wasn't tested and hurt people. And we can't talk about that like it relates to where we are now because of conflicts. I mean, that's just baffling to me. It had not been, to our knowledge, thoroughly tested, and they approved it anyway. And now, as they're screaming about vaccines and FDA always being right, it says, don't you think if you were a parent, you'd be a little bit concerned about that? Here was his answer. This is going to make you sick, I'm sure. He says, well, I am a parent and I do have, and he cuts in and says, would you be concerned about that? Mr. Glenn says this, I think with the type of knowledge that I have, already, the way it starts out, you already see it's not going to answer the question. Having worked for many years in the ethics field and understanding that some of these conflicts of interest really could be characterized as technical. Now, look, I could argue that there is a case where some things like this could be deemed not really important to the discussion. But the idea that you have financial interest in the very company that is producing the product that you're supposed to hold accountable, that is the absolute definition, beyond the best possible definition of conflict of interest. But here's what he says about it. For example, the ownership of stock, which is what I'm talking about. I think it's a good example. Remember, in evaluating your financial stake in the matter when you own stock, it's not the value of the stock you own, he says. Let's say you own 40,000, 50,000 worth of stock, whatever those numbers were that you were discussing earlier. The value of your financial interest in the matter is the potential for gain or loss to you. Yeah, thank you for explaining the basic concept of profit. It says, and when you own stock in a large publicly traded company, such as, I think Merck was the example. Yeah, you know damn well what we're talking about. He says, you really own a billionth of an interest in the company, which that may be correct, the math, but that does not mean what he says next. He says, so the likelihood that your personal financial interest in the matter is going to be affected, I think is pretty remote. So I really don't think it's inappropriate for agencies to issue waivers in those decisions. Okay, so he's arguing because you own $40,000 of a company that could possibly make billions of dollars with the sales of these vaccines, that that doesn't factor into your decision. I don't care if it's getting you $100. That is a conflict of interest. And all he's doing is downplaying the very, very lucrative conflicts of interest that are taking place. We just talked about Fauci and the people in the NIH that have potentially $100,000 a year kind of things coming their way if the Moderna vaccine, well, it already is. So that is what we're talking about. So in 2000, year 2000, they're openly calling this stuff out. Ask yourself how in the world we can be here and not have anything change. The only way that's possible is if they lost. That the very people that were pushing this agenda beat these people out, whether they were actually trying to change or not. At the end of the day, your government allowed the deceitful rise of this biosecurity state, using the illusion of pandemics and whatever else they're doing to control you. Now, going to the next point, and this is actually an interesting article in regard to the FDA and its review of this vaccine. Now, this wasn't something I put in the title. I was debating on whether this was one of the most important discussions, and you'll probably think it is, some of you. Remember, we're just talking about how the FDA is being accused of these obvious issues and the FDA approving vaccines that turned out to 100% be bad, like the one he just pointed to and said they know the rotavirus was not tested properly and they approved it anyway. Listen to how this article starts. But here's the point. Did the FDA understaff its review of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine? The answer is yes, according to the information, but I'll go through the whole process for you. So not only do we have everything else we've already talked about, but on top of that, this wildly accelerated, rushed review of this vaccine apparently only had one person in regard to this topic we're going to get into. So just added to the list of why this thing is arguably being, I mean, it's like they don't want people there to potentially see what's really going on. But here's how it starts. In what is arguably the most important decision the FDA has made this year, its emergency use authorization of the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine, the agency apparently assigned a single reviewer in each of the two key scientific disciplines, clinical statistics, to do the work in 3 weeks that usually takes months to do. It says the FDA's authorization last week followed similar authorizations in the United Kingdom and Canada, but the FDA's decision is particularly important because of its reputation for being the international gold standard in regulatory rigor. Yeah, well, I'm sure that's what we say. The truth is quite another story, though, because that's how the U.S. government operates, though. We just scream what we want people to think. Things happen in the world, and we grab the microphone, and we go, China did it! They did it! It was them over there! Before we could have any knowledge about what's happening, because it's important politically to control the narrative. So the idea that the FDA or any agency that's completely controlled by politics and pharmaceutical companies has any gold standard of anything is pretty laughable to me. That doesn't mean it couldn't be, or it was at one point. It means right now it is wildly co-opted by the obvious people involved with this. But sure, let's call it the gold standard, as we just talked about a rotavirus that they knowingly put out that was they didn't test, or any number of examples we've already talked about in the past. But it says the FDA is believed to be the only drug regulator in the world that consistently receives and reviews patient-level data from the clinical trials that underpin drug and vaccine approvals, which only stands to reason that it was more flagrant and dishonest when they didn't do what they were supposed to. But it says, given the urgency of the pandemic, the review of the Pfizer vaccine was conducted far faster than usual. The centerpiece of the analysis was data from the company's 44,000 participant phase 3 trial, which, remember, were 44,000 people that were involved, but it was a far, far, far less number of people who actually ended up getting sick, and far less than that ended up actually getting the vaccine. So the idea that 44,000 people is the way you do deal with the percentage of efficacy is a complete illusion. As we've already pointed out 100 times, according to numerous outlets, including the BMJ, the British Medical Journal, this was based on only 160, quote, events, is what they're calling it. That's straight from the BMJ. It says FDA reviewers had just 3 weeks, from November 20th to December 11th, to complete their analyses. It was a monumental task, which raises the question, why didn't the FDA devote additional reviewers to it? Right, because it's an increased speed of something that's very experimental and dangerous. Seems like you'd want more people involved, right? Unless there was something else going on. According to the FDA's review memo, so according to their data, some scientific disciplines, such as pharmacovigilance, monitoring you, had multiple reviewers involved. Oh, that's because that's what they care about. But the two disciplines tasked with examining the clinical trial data, you know, your safety and all, the clinical and statistical reviewers were seemingly left to do their work alone. So what that shows you is that the monitoring of your body after the fact is far more important to them, because it is, than making sure that the trials went well, because 6 months is not enough time to find out what's really going on. That's why these things, guess what? The normal trial period is 24 months, which is weirdly exactly the period they want to monitor what's happening in your body. What do you know about that? It's almost as if these safety things didn't even really happen. They're going to monitor your body when it happens. Just a thought. The facts are here for you to think about. According to the FDA, it says they, and Left to Do Solo, it says, this seems wholly inadequate on at least two levels, he says. First, without additional reviewers, it is hard to comprehend how the work of several months could be squeezed into a matter of 22 days, including Saturdays and Sundays. In-depth review called, basically meaning working 7 days a week. In-depth review calls for examining patient-level data, a large feat that involves auditing and reviewing individual case records, as well as independently running analyses on the raw data. It says, before the pandemic, it was typical to see just one clinical reviewer's name for any given application. But given the stakes and the time crunch, it says, involved with reviewing COVID-19 vaccines, we would have thought the agency would do an even more thorough job than normal, right? Not less review than normal. That doesn't even make sense. Like, same thing I keep saying, because their claim is you're in so much danger that we have to be like, for your safety, we have to do far less safety review. How does that make sense? It doesn't. It says, but that does not appear to be the case, that they did more. It says, one of us raised questions about potential unblinding in the trials through the vaccine side effects, as well as about the confounding effects of fever and pain-reducing medications. You probably haven't heard this before, which participants in the vaccine arm took 3 to 4 times more often than those in the placebo arm. Does that not seem like a way to obviously game the outcome? You're giving people who could be having more severe side effects pain-reducing, fever-reducing medications. So you mean the people that probably had higher fever and more pain didn't even know it because you were pumping them full of medications that stop those things and giving far less of that to the placebo arm? Guys, this is so flagrantly dishonest. They were making, you know why? Because they have $1 billion on the line, multi-billion dollars, potentially trillions to continue. I mean, think about how important this is to all their stock shareholders, to everything. This is a profit motive. So what they're telling you there is they gave medications to the people on the vaccine side that reduced the visual appearance of how they were reacting to what they were giving them. That is not how this is supposed to work. That's gaming the outcome. It says, yet the FDA's review shows no evidence that any of the scientists investigated either of these issues. And without more scientific staff devoted to the task, it is hard to imagine how they could. Yeah. It says, such differing opinions were on display at last week's FDA Advisory Committee meeting, where 4 advisors voted against the emergency use authorization that the FDA ultimately granted the next day. But of course, that was the FDA's external advisory committee. Ah, so this goes back to the point we were just talking about, that sure, the people that you're told are supposed to keep you safe, the FDA advisory committee, they all voted no. But then this external committee that probably includes people with just flagrant conflicts of interest, they, of course, passed it the very next day. I bet you people have never even heard either one of those things. Do you know how relevant that is? The fact that that the FDA committee actually all vote no on this emergency use, but this special advisory external committee are the next day are the ones that pushed it out. That sounds like a shadow government scenario, that the FDA is the illusion and the real group are the ones that make the calls. At the same time, we're watching them pump the people that get the vaccine full of drugs that hide the side effects. I mean, this is outrageous. All of this is here for you to look at, guys. The stats and the facts and everything is here for you to read. Now, the important part to follow up on, so you know that I'm giving you the full picture, is that today this was followed up with the response from the people they were talking about, and then their response to what they were saying. So the actual article you can see starts all the way down here, but this is all their thing. I'm not going to go through all of it. The bottom line is what you would expect. They wrote out and they said, "You're wrong. You're so crazy, and none of that makes sense," like they always do. But here's the one point that is the real important part, because the article is about understaffing the supposed safety trial review after the fact. It says the authors cite FDA's clinical review memo. They're saying that's wrong. So because they cited the FDA memo that stated that regarding the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine as evidence that more staff should have been assigned to conduct the reviews. But he says, but in fact, more than 100 staff, including senior management from across FDA's Center for Biologics. That's so weird why that was difficult for me to say. Evaluation and research and FDA as a whole contributed to this effort. So he's saying, no. You silly, you stupid. You know, I always try to put the slant on it. He's clearly calling them out and saying, you're wrong. Why would you just trust our information? Like, that's crazy. And this is their response to it. He says, regarding the depth of the FDA review, Mark says that more than 100 staff contributed to the effort. And that the individual names listed as the review team are simply the leads for each review discipline. He said, they say, we believe this too, but wonder why two individuals are listed for pharmacovigilance, you know, the 24 months after the fact, for three and three for chemistry, manufacturing, and controls, but only one each for clinical, biostatistics, and toxicology. One. It says, more importantly, as we explained, our concern is not simply about the quantity of reviewers. It's about quantity of the process, quality of the process. That's the point. So it doesn't matter whether you want it. The point is you rushed this process and you're trying to make it seem like it's the opposite. It says, we remain concerned that there were no clear structural mechanisms by which reviewers who might have held dissenting views about the strengths and limitations of the application could freely document and discuss their concerns. Now, it was, I think I didn't highlight it, but he basically says, right there, it says that Mark faults us for taking at face value what's written in the FDA memo. Like, just think about how stupid that is. So he calls them out for reading what they wrote and saying, you're wrong. Let me state the opposite of what our memo says and claim that's the truth. And it may be the truth. The point is, it's getting a little ridiculous how it's like these people are being disparaged as fake news conspiracy theorists when all they did was point to what the FDA said. And at the end of the day, his argument doesn't really change the fact that it's obvious that this was not done the proper way. That's alarming, along with a lot of other things that are alarming. Now, one of the last really important parts I'm going to get into here before we kind of just rattle off a few things at the end is another really important discussion about the genetic manipulation of what this vaccine is, which is a hugely contentious thing that, now, and, you know, just like we're seeing across this whole process. We say, look, the sky is blue. And they go, no, you're a conspiracy theorist. It's actually turquoise. You guys don't know what you're talking about. And all they're really doing is playing word games. And they're manipulating your understanding of things that should be quite clear. Now, in this case, I've been saying from the very beginning, based on the obvious facts and the idea that long before COVID-19 came around, the discussion of mRNA vaccines were unequivocal. These are genetically modified vaccines. That's what they are. And the fact is they very clearly affect your genetics and they change your body. That's a fact. And that was stated routinely before COVID-19 came around and vaccine hesitancy became a real issue. And so they had to start censoring the truth and saying the truth was fake because, wink, wink, it's actually real, but we know it'll stop you from getting vaccinated. Here's the problem here. They're lying to you. And this is not hard to see. Now, I'm going to stay away completely from even arguing that it alters your DNA because that's this phrase they're using to disparage all of this. But even that, understand, when we play this next clip, you're going to see very quickly that that's something that should be argued or at least discussed. But first of all, this is a PhD. I think it's Peter Borger. A PhD and is an expert in molecular genetics. All right. So I would hands down trust any PhD over the two people on their couch in this room working for Snopes. But it says Snopes fact checkers. Remember, we just went over this the other day. So I was really happy to see a PhD saying exactly what I was saying. Snopes fact checkers are wrong about mRNA vaccines. Snopes, who claims to do fact checking, writes, quote, no, mRNA vaccines, COVID vaccines do not alter your DNA. Snopes did not even begin to check the science facts. Thank you, PhD, for saying the truth and having the courage to speak out. But now we're going to get into a video that is very important. Now, here's actually the video itself. I'll play the link. I'll play it for you. Dr. Alexandria Henrion Cloud, I believe. She's a geneticist from France and somebody that you, an intelligent medical professional that you should be listening to. At the very least, be considering what she's saying. And of course, this is the part where she's speaking is pretty much the only part that's in English. The rest of it seems to be in French, but you need to listen to everything she says because I'm only going to talk about a couple of her points. But she is saying pretty much everything that we're talking about. Added to the list, another very well-respected medical professional who is calling out the entire illusion of where we are. Crazy. But let's watch the clip. Now, this is a good clip, so I'm going to try not to talk as, you know, I'm trying to limit my comments as best I can because this could take quite a long time if I don't, you know, go through this reasonably quickly. So let's take a look.
Dr. Alexandra Henrion-Code is geneticist. She's very known in France because she also had the Eisenhower Fellow, which is a prestigious prize. Very few French people have it.
Thank you for putting up such a fantastic and awesome program.
I just want to quickly point out that I think it's really humorous that there's so many people today trying to use Zoom and the way this and they're so confused about the process. And it's not like a knock on anybody. It's just because they're not used to using it. So I feel bad for this intelligent person who is being put up before she knows she's on screen and her face is moving. You know, it's like the argument is the people at the tables should be the ones to understand and know, but everyone's learning on the fly because they're not used to doing it like this. Anyway, don't let that reflect on who this person is because she has very strong credentials and very intelligent. Listen to her speak.
Enables us to speak science, to speak whatever our field of expertise is in a free manner. And I have to say that I miss quite a lot those exchanges in a free manner where other scientists challenges you and you have this ping pong thing.
I do too. What she's telling you there is that there's no actual free debate anymore. There's not any actual free discussion or dialogue. It's either you go along with what the mainstream consensus says or you're a conspiracy theorist. And that's what she's saying right there.
And I will move on to the part which is important is the fact that those vaccines are so-called vaccines. I prefer to say those genetically engineered experimental vaccines, because this is exactly what they are dealing with our genetics. And this is very important because one has to understand and has to have an updated view on what is our current knowledge on genome, on our heredity, and not in old view that messenger RNA is something very static and very ideal, that it does exactly what you want it to do. What is heredity? Heredity is no longer only based on genetics, but it is based also on epigenetics. What is epigenetics? Genetics, people have now understood what we are talking about. It is this idea that those two honeybees, one is a queen on the left side, the other one is a worker on the right side. And they have the same DNA, meaning they have the same genetics. Yet you do see that their morphology is rather different. Even like the abdomen doesn't have the same stripes, the size, the behavior, and the organs are not the same. So what is it? Is it that heredity is only linked to genetics? No, it means that there is something else. And this something else, interestingly enough, is about the epigenetics. So
I find this to be really fascinating because the concept is, you know, what she basically, there's a lot to her discussion that I hope you'll take. It's a lot of scientific talk. But it's really important to fully understand all of this. And what she's saying is that they're, again, as usual, abusing people's ignorance on these topics. And what she's saying is that the actual experts anywhere who fully understands genetics and the current data that the current research knows that they're manipulating the general perception for people. Right now, the idea, like what she's saying, is that the DNA is oversimplified in the way that they perceive it and the way that they talk about it today. Where these bees have the same DNA, the same genetics, but they're very different, right? So the idea that you can make it all, like the idea that it's that simple is wrong. And this ties into the idea of where, with all these discussions they're having, we're talking about in regard to the side effects and what we're possibly going to see from these experimental vaccines. Now, realize again also that this is an experiment. It's an experimental vaccine. That's not a secret. And it wasn't a secret before we got to COVID-19. The MERS, the SARS, they were all experimental vaccines. But the moment COVID happened, because they have a huge agenda they're trying to cover, now you're not allowed to call it an experimental vaccine. It's just dumb.
Which makes those bees look so different, the queen and the worker, and behave so differently, is the epigenetic, which is basically the changes that the environment brings to your genomic information altogether. So we are talking of DNA, of RNA, and even now of recently, since the discovery of circulating factors that all influence your epigenetics. So when we talk of mRNA, we talk of all these information that are embedded in the sequence.
Now, just so you know, by the way, this is edited. I made that clear, but just so we're aware, this is edited. In no way am I changing the content, but just know that this is an hour and something long. So there's clearly cuts here between the things, even though it may not seem like there's a cut. There was a cut there, just jumping from topic to topic. Just so you know, so it's do your due diligence and watch this entirely. But I'll continue.
So when we talk of mRNA, we talk of all these information that are embedded in the sequence. Given this fantastic knowledge that I think completely revolutionizes our understanding of genome, our understanding of heredity, we are putting up a rushed development of these experimental procedures to put up vaccines, genetically engineered vaccine at a worldwide scale. This is the worry. This is the concern. And the concern is that through this rush development, any serious adverse events, instead of being the observed during 24 months, as it is normally what is taking place,
that's where I heard that. And I just want that. And that is actually true. What I find interesting is that it correlates exactly with what they're claiming will be their potential pharmacovigilance, which is monitoring the vaccine and its possible side effects in your body. So instead of the 24-month process to do that in a lab, they're doing a 24-month process in your body. Just make sure we're fully understanding that.
It will be, it has been cut down to 6 months. Within 6 months, they will be observing the serious adverse events with a rushed experimental procedure. So we see that something is going in the wrong direction. We immediately see that, you know, we have to put a halt as a scientist because we have this knowledge. We have to share what we know, and we have to say, this the path we are taking is a dangerous one. Most, if not all, strategies of vaccine that are summarized in this table have never been used in humans, and most of the time either never been tested in animals. This is one serious concern again, is that not only they are rushed, but also they were never used and never really fully experienced or tested in animals. You have different types of vaccines. You have the GMO vaccines, you have the mRNA vaccines, you have the DNA vaccines, and you have some specificity in different recombinant, different nanoparticles of vaccines using different, even plant cells, a wide variety of parameters that are completely new. I have summarized here some of the current challenges that we are facing. The first challenges that I see is the indication of a public health policy in regards to COVID-19 vaccines. Given what Pascal has presented, what the other doctor has presented, we have a number of treatments that exist.
So this part, she's basically saying that they have a lot of treatments that should be used that are being deemed dangerous and bad and wrong. We've all seen this. There's 100 different arguments from whatever political side you're on of which one's the best one and blah, blah, blah. The point is we should all have the opportunity to do whatever we think is correct for your body. Based on doctor's recommendation, but it should be your choice to put whatever you want to put in your body. At some point along our history, it became what the doctor tells you to do, and it's not your choice anymore. That's crazy. And that happened quite quickly and quite recently. But no, that's not how it should be.
Epidemics, and we have realized after the epidemics was gone that the strategy of a public health policy of vaccination was not the solution. We should be learning from our past experience. And therefore, we should strongly raise the indication of a public health policy of anti-COVID-19 vaccine strategy.
And by the way, she mentions H1N1 more than once as learning from our mistakes. So I can't, you know, this person clearly sees the reality as far as I'm concerned.
Number two, are the people who are currently getting the vaccines informed that they are currently being enrolled in a biomedical protocol? This is a question I raise. And the reason being that the clinical trials are still ongoing. The clinical trials of all the laboratories that I've showed to you on the different strategies are ongoing. Yet, people are being vaccinated, and to the best of my understanding, they are not informed that they are being enrolled in a biomedical protocol.
So think about that in regard to the pharmacovigilance, right? They're still going. And they're already pushing the vaccine out. So arguably, you're still in the trial, right? This is the kind of thing she's talking about, that they're, you know, this is the media sells you a narrative, but based on the facts and what's happening, people are not being informed that they're currently in, as she calls it, a biomedical protocol. That's quite alarming, because if they did, well, people probably would say no.
This is very well explained on this article. On the right-hand side.
By the way, this is the article that we just went over. The BMJ points to this. This is Peter Doshi and discussing exactly what we already talked about, right? The idea that not only were the trials designed to succeed, but that they, all of this, this is everything we've been talking about, being confirmed by experts and medical professionals.
That was recently published and stating from Cardozo and Vizi from New York, who are saying informed consent disclosure to vaccine trial subjects of risk of COVID-19 vaccines worsening clinical disease. And what they are basically saying in this article is that we need, given our past experience on anti-coronavirus vaccination, we need to specifically inform the patient that the risk are that it will worsen the clinical disease. How does it do that? In fact, it is based on a phenomenon which is called antibody-dependent enhancement.
Simply ADE. We've already talked about this. ADE is where you'll see it referenced, but it's antibody-dependent enhancement. And this is we've already been talking about pathogenic priming, right? What's interesting is I'm not sure if these are two separate things that both cause the same outcome, which is an increased of risk of what you took the vaccine for, or if they're different names for the same thing. But at the end of the day, we are talking about examples of very real risks that they are not telling you about, that they have seen in past coronavirus vaccines that have been, we talked about the dengue fever one for Fauci was involved with, killed hundreds of kids. Because they got pathogenic priming and increased their risk. And that's why they didn't continue these. And that's why they're experimental. But here we are, testing it on you.
And this antibody-dependent enhancement makes that, yes, you may have been producing antibodies, but those antibodies, instead of being neutralizing, instead of neutralizing the disease, will actually have the reverse effect of facilitating the disease, of facilitating the entry of the virus into your cell, of facilitating the replication sometimes of the viruses. This is a very big concern, which explains to you why there has never been any approved vaccination on any coronavirus, on any SARS-1, on any MERS. And this is something that should be raised to the people.
Exactly.
Other aspect, the gene modification. Yes or no?
This is the crux of the issue here. And I know this is what most people want to hear because of the arguments here. Now, remember, this is a geneticist, right? This is a medical professional. This is somebody who has the right to speak on this topic and has the credentials. Okay. And what she's going to tell you will challenge the narrative.
I don't know in other countries, but in France, it seems to be a total consensus. Those vaccines are not going to change to bring any gene modification. So I wonder what we are talking about. And this is again a big misunderstanding coming back to the root of the basis. We are talking typically of mRNA vaccine, Pfizer, BioNTech, or Moderna strategy. Those mRNA vaccines, those genetically engineered experimental vaccines, are designed for you to for human to start producing a protein that they never produced before. So I have to say that I am not playing the fool, but I'm just trying to understand how can these people be saying that it is not modifying your genome when it is actually bringing an information to your body that your body didn't have.
Okay, so here's a geneticist telling you that she's confused about why they're saying this doesn't change your genetic makeup. Let that sink in.
Your body was not a producer of an industrial producer of a spike protein of this virus. This is an issue. Now, are there other ways beside the fact that you are going to produce a protein that you never produced before, in the hope that maybe it will turn on an immunologic response, and apparently the efficiency as to synthesizing antibody is strong. But now, are these antibodies facilitating antibodies or neutralizing antibodies?
Are they facilitating antibodies or are they neutralizing antibodies? That seems like a wildly relevant question. So is it going to hurt you or is it going to help you? I guess they don't know that yet.
Nobody knows. And this comes back to this article from Cardozo that I mentioned about the specific risk of worsening the disease with anti-coronavirus.
Now, let me just say one thing really quickly. I have my opinions that I think you probably are aware of. But this is not to suggest that we know as a matter of fact that this is going to happen everywhere all the time. The point is, this is a possibility, and that is a fact. And so you, as an individual with self-determination, so we're told, should have the right as an adult to decide for yourself, based on the history of this government, based on the history of the FDA, based on the history of the CDC, based on the history of fake and illusory pandemics in this country. You have the right, regardless of any of those things, by the way, you have the right to speak your mind and say, no, I don't want that thing because I have the right to say no. As the UNESCO document and the United Nations clearly state that your individual rights supersede that of the society or science as a whole. That's clear. They don't care about that. Just make sure we're clear on that. They don't care about your rights. They care about the agenda. As this geneticist is literally telling you what they refuse to allow you to hear.
The the modification that mRNA may bring and cannot, in other words, I don't see a way that it cannot have an impact on the epigenetic of your cell. Because
in case you didn't hear her accent there, she said she doesn't see how there's a way that this vaccine cannot affect your epigenetics, meaning that it will, in her opinion, as a geneticist, absolutely manipulate your genetics. It will change. I mean, this is what I was saying laughingly the other day. If you're describing this thing as being put in your body, a genetically modified idea, you're genetically engineering this mRNA being put into your body, and that's their state. They call it engineered mRNA. Put into your body. That goes into your cell, which it causes it to create a protein that it's never created before. Like, is anybody confused on how that sounds? I don't care what you want to call that. As I said yesterday, I don't want to, if you want to incorrectly call that edit altering your DNA, if you want to call it, as I said, dancing in the sun, it doesn't matter. Call it whatever you want. That's alarming. And that is something that we shouldn't be okay with. Just because they want to sidestep it and go, you're wrong about what you're calling it. It's not something we should be okay with. And it's not something we're being told about. All they can do is act like you're crazy and ignore you.
As you saw my introduction on you know, putting you all the cartoon of the fantastic fluidity and even changes that RNA bring within the cell, you cannot be in the expectation that this mRNA is not going to have an epigenetic influence on your cells. This is, to me, not reasonable. And this goes completely against all the fantastic improvement that we have made in our knowledge and all the literature that has been ongoing on SARS-CoV-2 and epigenetics and within the last month.
So not only are they ignoring the genetic information and research of the last so many years, but they're actually, as she's saying, ignoring the current info about SARS-CoV-2. Why? Because that makes them stop what they're trying to achieve. If the current data is, think of it like this. We're still on lockdown. They said 3.4% death rate. You're all going to die. Everybody's got to lock down. And that's clearly ended up being false. And yet we're still doing it. They're not acknowledging the current data. They're only pointing back to what they said was going to happen and continue to claim that you're at risk. Same thing's happening here.
Which is a huge piece of literature in the field. And now in terms of changing your DNA, one can have the concern that your cells may have reverse transcriptase because maybe you are HIV or because maybe you have other viruses that provide you with reverse transcriptase, and your mRNA may become a DNA and may modify your genome. This has to be foreseen as a possibility, and therefore this has to be studied.
Meaning that they knew it's a possibility. As she said, they should have. This is foreseen. They knew this was a possibility. One, they didn't tell you about it. And two, they don't seem to care.
And unfortunately, I didn't see that genetic parameters, genotoxicity, were in the list of the things that had to be studied. So to conclude, I will say that a vaccine, my question is, how can we be producing or not producing, but like putting up vaccination policies when vaccines were not made for the severe cases of COVID-19 and were not made to prevent transmission human to human? Can we call them vaccine? And is a genetically engineered vaccine that is completely experimental, can it be called again a vaccine? Or does the word experimental need always to be tied up with the word vaccine?
Yes, it does.
And as well as the genetically engineered, because this is completely new strategies that were never done in human and that can have a great number of consequences. Innovation is great. And that's why Astrid, all of us scientists are working on. Innovation yet is not always a synonym of progress.
Very important point.
Is it a progress to change our consideration of human integrity? Why do I say that? Is because when we are using mRNA vaccine on healthy individuals, and to me this healthy aspect is really important, we consider human being as a biotech tool to be producing a virus, a viral protein. So we are engineered as to being the producer. This is touching our human integrity. This is a critical aspect that one has to really embrace in terms of the revolution that is coming along with this change of human integrity.
We are becoming a biological tool for them, meaning, as this geneticist is telling you, that's what they're thinking too. Technically speaking, right? So they're engineering you to be the purveyor of this thing they're creating. That's directly from the geneticist who understands these things. Now, this is something that you need to take it, understand it, consider other people's opinions. But the point is that if you're only listening to what the mainstream doctors and scientists are telling you on the TVs that are being paid, and these platforms have financial influence from the pharmaceutical industries, which, by the way, is the largest advertiser for all of the mainstream outlets you listen to, you're not doing yourself a service. It's on you to do your to broaden out and find all the. This is an individual who knows what they're talking about. That's an individual who clearly is not biased by one. This is just the facts. As she said in the beginning, it's not about one side or the other. This is about the facts. Now, somebody talking in the chat, it's the point to understand about this is not really, this can be confusing stuff. It really can. And I'm not arguing that I fully understand all the ins and outs of this stuff, because that's what, you know, that's someone like her went to school for a decade to understand this stuff, if not more. But the point is to simply understand that there's DNA and then mRNA, RNA are things that are arguably within this or different parts of themselves. But at the end of the day, what she said is that ultimately these things can amount to something that would alter your genetic makeup. An absolute, well, first of all, it will, 100%. This is genetically engineered, that is genetically modifying you and how it, whether that lasts forever or a day, it's happening. So you cannot pretend like just because it goes away that it's not genetic modification. That's what they're trying to play with the definition too. That, oh, well, you can't, because of the definition, it states the bubble. That's ridiculous. You are genetically modifying something that changes your body in a way that's never been done before. I'll just repeat it just like that if I have to. They'll still censor that too. But at the end of the day, it's about how it affects you and how they're holding that information from your view. And that just cannot be any less. It's just, this is one of the most important things I think we could talk about today. It's an experiment. That's why the pharmacovigilance is happening in your body. Now, to finish off here, after we're finding out that our government has spent decades covering up the reality of the dangerous situation we're in and allowing the growth of the biosecurity state to then use that power to continue to overcome and take control over the interests and directions of your politicians and your entities and your company or agencies like the FDA and the CDC that are there specifically to hold them accountable, but now are completely co-opted and controlled by the same entities. You can see how they've allowed this all to build. You can see how this is all there. And now they're pushing out things that are designed just like they're telling you are actually not happening. Where you can see the experts that are not being swayed by the mainstream media circles telling you this is a dangerous thing that has side effects that could potentially be dangerous. And that has to weigh on your decision. Now, as we can see here, several COVID-19 vaccine recipients got Bell's palsy. We already talked about this. But here's the news saying here's why you should just ignore all of that very real stuff. And all they're basically saying is that, oh, well, it's what it says right here. It's actually more common than you think. That's their argument. It's more common than people think. And it usually goes away in a couple weeks. Or it doesn't, though. You know, it could, or it might last the rest of your life, whatever. But you shouldn't worry about any of that, though, because if you do, you're a crazy conspiracy theorist. This is essentially the argument. Oh, these social media. What does that even mean? The truth is, they got that, beyond a shadow of a doubt. What they want to argue is that because of the normal occurrence of this in the population, that's just what it was. Then all four of these people, at different times in their vaccine process, all got Bell's palsy. And that's just supposed to be a natural thing. And you know what? It could be. It's certainly possible. But that the argument that you should ignore that is crazy to me. Like, no honest individual is going to tell you, here's true information, but don't look at it. Ignore it. That's how desperate these people are. But don't forget, though, regardless of everything we've already talked about and all the dangerous side effects that are possible and the fact, I mean, everything that you know, remember that you can't sue these companies no matter what. even if you've got a severe reaction. The government likely won't compensate you for those damages either, because it's next to impossible to actually prove that this happened through the compensation court that's supposed to be a conspiracy theory in certain circles. Like the $4 billion plus that's been paid out for actual vaccine injury, but yet if you point out that vaccines can cause damage, you're a conspiracy theorist. Just like today. It just doesn't make sense. It does not align with the truth. But here's another interesting point that we should point out. And I'm sure everybody has seen all the discussions, which I was contemplating talking about them today, but it just sort of seems irrelevant. The discussion of the nurse passing out. I mean, there's a lot of side effects and we all see that. So the idea that it's happening shouldn't be a secret to you right now. But we know that a nurse passed out minutes after she was given the injection and then told us after the fact that it was something that happens to her all the time, despite during the process, she was clearly confused and worried, right? But yeah, but that's a normal thing I do all the time, but we didn't know it was going to happen. Yeah, cool. But it's just them trying to lie for their truth, in my opinion. But we also see examples of nurses getting shots that clearly didn't happen. And even mainstream articles are saying, I might as well just point to it now that I'm showing you this. Here's even Fox News telling you that it's clear. This one example, there was obviously nothing in the syringe, but all the other ones before and after it clearly had a full syringe. So all the people saying, no, it was only a small amount in the syringe. They lied. They knowingly lied and got caught, because you can see as it goes through that he doesn't even push it. But ask yourself why they would try to deceive you on that. Ask yourself why this person would do something like that and then weirdly pull it back up and then push it back down again, right? Like that's totally normal. There's something crazy going on and why that would even happen. But the point, the reason I was, you know, I'm not really going to dive down this rabbit hole is because there's a lot of hypotheticals flying around. But at the end of the day, all they can basically do is say, oh, well, after numerous reports have emerged on social media claiming that he didn't get the vaccine, we want to remove any doubt that he wasn't fully vaccinated, they said. They said the nurse in question got vaccinated again. Oh, okay, because you were telling us forcefully that he got it. You proved that by giving him another one that he didn't need the day after. And then followed that up by saying, but don't worry, giving him revaccinations can't cause effects. Except that the one can cause effects. So they're just completely making this up. Why would you give him a vaccine the very next day if he got the one the day before that? It's because it didn't happen. And for whatever reason, they lied about that. And they didn't come back and say like they did before that, oh, it was a Photoshop shoot and he already got it before, but we did it for the TV. No, they knowingly deceived you for some reason and in a very flagrant way got caught for it. And now they just gave him a vaccine the next day. So we're told, because that one's not on TV. I just find this stuff to be very strange. But of course, there's a lot of possibility and unexplained things around this, you know, whether, I mean, there's all kinds of discussions here. But we've already showed you the example of the Australian First Minister that did the same thing. And that was, I might not have been clear about that last time. That was from before. That wasn't COVID-19. But that was a past event where they were doing the same thing and going, look, I got my shot. And then clearly the cap was still on. And all they said was, oh, well, we just did a photo shoot. It was because, you know, we already did it before. So now we're just going to do it again with the cap on for the TV, right? That's actually their argument. My entire screen just froze up here, so I'm just trying to go past this here. But here, let me just pull this away. Oh, well, that's interesting. It appears as if my entire setup is frozen, even my OBS. Here we go. That's quite strange. It looks like my camera might have froze. Anyway, let's just keep going in case this happens right now. But to keep it going forward, remember that they can't be held accountable, despite all the things that we're seeing, and that you won't even get damages, most likely, if you try to sue them. But pointing this out, the reactions, a suburban hospital has already temporarily paused its vaccinations, quote, out of abundance of caution. But it's fake news to pretend like there's serious things happening. Following adverse reactions, like this is their statement, out of abundance of caution, we are temporarily pausing vaccinations. But I mean, think about how crazy it is that we're staring at that reality, and yet they're pretending like any concern from the independent media is just a bunch of fake news. Isn't that incredible? Dang it. Sorry. I'm trying to fix this camera real quick because I don't know why that's happening right now. There we go. Now we're back. Okay. Apologies for that. Now you can see I fixed my camera. Okay. Let's continue. It's interesting that they would pause this. I mean, I'm actually shocked that NBC even reported this, because this will cause what they're talking about as vaccine hesitancy. Like that's irrespective, like regardless of whether or not hesitancy is justified, you just can't cause vaccine hesitancy today. No, it's not allowed. But as I said, if this is how it started, right, right out of the gates, imagine how it will end. Hashtag informed consent. Now, Moderna, interestingly enough, just had to discard 400,000 doses of its vaccine after a manufacturing issue compromised the product. But it remains on track to meet its production estimates. Don't worry. I just thought that was a little bit ridiculous, because the idea that 400,000 vaccines could somehow have an issue with the product. What happens if that happens and they didn't catch it? Right? But we're not allowed to question the safety of these things. Do you see how ridiculous this is? The idea that these people are immune from liability, that they have indemnity with something that is experimental, rushed, never been done before, never been tested on animals, and now we're seeing examples of them having issues with the production. How much you want to bet that gets blamed on a Iran cyber attack or something else, or that just gets blamed on COVID-19 when things start happening? It's incredible. But I also want to point out how even Moderna calls it an experimental vaccine. But sure, we're crazy for continuing to state that as far as the mainstream media is concerned. I just love that. I mean, it's incredible, as we keep seeing in the chat, right? The facts are fake news today. It's incredible. But on top of all of it, yep, your employees have now gotten the green light to require that vaccine for you to work again. This is coming from the Unequal Employment Opportunity Commission, and they've determined that employers can require workers to get vaccinated against COVID-19 and offered guidance on expectations. This is going to blow your mind, the way they've tried to make this equitable. Employers have been hoping for clarity, I'm sure. I love how they put that on us. We've all been clamoring for explicit, like, no, we haven't. That's what you want us to think. But employers have been hoping for clarity from the agency as they mull whether to mandate vaccination. You know, that thing that's never supposed to happen because it's fake news conspiracy theory. Even as many people remain concerned about the safety of a vaccine developed so quickly and not tested on certain populations or animals for that matter. But don't forget, Pfizer screamed at us all that they didn't cut any corners. Right, because we can trust that guy. And I knew I'd have this here for a reason. Don't forget, of all the times they've lied to us. Specifically speaking, the False Claims Act and related, they've paid out over $1 billion from 23 different records for lying about safety. Or false claims. Safety-related offenses. $104 million, 10 different records for lying about safety. What do you know about that? Isn't that relevant? Apparently not to the mainstream media. But going forward, it says the EEOC said employers can require that employees get inoculated as a condition of going to work. Unless, of course, an employee declines because of a disability or sincerely held religious belief. Oh, okay, so you can't have like a kind of held religious belief. Do you not realize how ridiculous that is? So they're arguing right there that you're going to lie about your religious beliefs, which probably happened, guarantee happens. But you know what? It's not their choice. If I can identify with whatever gender I want right now, I'm pretty sure I can decide on whatever religion I want. And you don't get to pick and choose whether I'm being honest about it. It's my choice with my body, my religion. You know, all these things that they used to say, but now don't care about, is only if it applies to COVID-19. Like, I was just laughing about that video of that man hunting that woman around the store, screaming at her. Do you know if that happened before we got here? That guy would have been accused of rape and, oh my God, this guy's harassing this woman. But no, that didn't happen at all. It's incredible how this stuff is flipped and flopped around because it's about the agenda. But yeah, but you have to have a sincerely held religious belief. But guess it goes even further. It says in such cases, though, now there's a caveat, even if you're sincerely religious, the employer must offer a reasonable accommodation to the employee, such as working remotely. Oh, okay, so now we can force you to go home and work. As long as the accommodation doesn't cause, quote, undue hardship. And who decides if it's undue? Sure, the government or the employer, I would imagine, for the employer. If there is no accommodation possible, so if none of that applies and you can't do anything, well, the employer may prohibit the employee from just entering the premises. Oh, God. So he can keep you on, it says, but not necessarily fire the worker. So he can keep you on, but he just will stop you from entering the building. Nowhere in there does it discuss whether or not he still gets paid or, you know, who cares about any of that, though. The bottom line is they're now given the green light to require that you have to get vaccinated before you can go to work. This is just one more example of them making this the case before you can re-enter the Great Reset World Economic Forum built world that's based on a COVID-19 biosecurity state. And a bunch of lies. But to finish off here, make sure you remember that Donald Trump just tweeted out, all-time stock market high, the vaccine and the vaccine rollout are, with both capitals, by the way, which I don't really understand, the vaccine, because the point is, it's his vaccine. Don't forget that. Despite all of the arguments that it's a fake 4D chess move and he'll never let it happen, it'll never happen, the vaccine and the vaccine rollouts are getting the best of reviews. Right from Pfizer people and from government people, but anyone being honest with themselves can see some horrifying things happening. It says moving along really well. Yeah, good times. Those, and this is what I don't understand. Get those shots in quotes. Everyone. Also, stimulus talks looking really good. Here's my argument. That is just to make sure that the people that want to believe he still won't let this happen, give them their out. I saw 100 tweets with just shots in quotes. Because in their minds, they're going, wink, wink, nudge, nudge. He doesn't mean real shots. He means shots like rounding up the pedos and shooting them all or something like that. I haven't seen that yet, but I promise that's out there. And you know what? Who knows? Anything's possible. But the reality is, guys, that you're being played. That this has always been his agenda and always been their groundabout all two-party illusion agenda. And he's the reason that those of you who've trusted him, he's the reason that it's going forward, because most of you that trust him would probably have never let this get this far if he wasn't in that position. Get your shots, guys. And of course, this person rightly responds, wow, so glad the stock market's doing great. This is just perfect. December 17th. As of today, we received $4.51 a day to get through this pandemic. That's 451 pennies a day. But don't forget that they've given millions and trillions and billions to different companies, and Walmart and Coca-Cola and Walt and Disney and Boeing. And, you know, they've bailed them out left and right. And you have gotten 451 pennies a day. Good times. But good thing the stock market's up, though, because we know how much the average person cares about that. One of the last points here I find really odd, because they keep pushing this idea that this is, you know, we only have a limited supply, right? So everybody rush out and get it before, and then we're going to have a second round. Except it looks like that's not actually true. Here's what Pfizer had to say. Waiting on shipment of instructions for millions of vaccine doses. So the U.S. government is telling us that they have a limited access to these vaccines to begin with. So we can only roll out so many, right? I argue that was an obvious intentional false scarcity to drive people to rush in and get it first. Pfizer saying, we've got lots of vaccines just sitting here and we're waiting for them to take it. Pfizer has millions of vaccine doses sitting in a warehouse awaiting shipping orders from the U.S. government. It says, as U.S. states report delays and apparent reductions in deliveries. Well, that doesn't seem to add up. Oh, look, I'm not arguing that we want this thing or should even. I'm arguing that the last thing we should be doing right now is taking this. But at the end of the day, they're telling us there's a delay and that there's a shortage. At the same time, Pfizer's saying we've got millions just waiting and you guys are creating a false scarcity. The drug company in a press release said it is not experiencing production issues with the vaccine, as the Trump administration has claimed. What? And no shipments are on hold or delayed. Can anybody explain that? My opinion, it's because they want to, as I said, create false scarcity to drive people who might not get it to rush out and get it first. Meanwhile, if you believe this is really happening, they are letting people get sick and die for the appearance of scarcity. That's not what I think is happening, but you know, for everyone in their own perspective. Quote, this week we successfully shipped all 2.1 million doses that we were asked to ship, right? Meaning they've got 100 million more sitting there. All 2.9 million doses that we were asked to ship by the U.S. government to the location specified by them. We have millions more doses sitting in our warehouse, but as of now, we have not received any shipment issued instructions for additional doses. This whole thing is an illusion. This whole damn scenario is an illusion, guys. Every single part of this is being gamed and controlled and manipulated. Here is Sky News. Again, this was yesterday. Telling you, they reported the day before, they reported the day before that. They're making sure that you don't miss this. New COVID variant spreading faster than previous strain. Or is it something else happening right now? What else is happening right now? Oh, that's right, the rollout of an experimental vaccine. Maybe, just maybe, this weird new variant, which the recent studies from Nature already showed aren't actually causing more transmission. Maybe that's actually something other than a new variant spreading faster. which is contradicting what the new science just said. You know, whatever, though. Maybe. I'll let you decide for yourself. But to finish off here, as John Rappaport says, let's apply the same criteria for COVID deaths. If a person dies within 30 days after taking the vaccine, well, we'll call that a vaccine death. Now, the point here in being facetious is to realize how backward their logic is with this, intentionally so. To argue that anyone that dies within 30 days of being tested with a false positive test and being told they have COVID is a way to make sure this is an illusion. But the logic being applied in the exact same way wouldn't happen here. Why? We want to err on the side of caution. We want to be safe. We want to make sure, just like they're arguing with COVID, we're going to make sure. So any death afterward, we're going to make sure. And we'll just do that just to be safe. Of course, that wouldn't happen because they would argue they don't want you thinking about the death and side effects of these vaccines. If the logic applies in one case, it would apply in the other. Meanwhile, after all of this is happening and all the problems are happening and all they can talk about is COVID-19, as he points out, who's going to flatten these curves? Right? Unemployment, bankruptcy, suicide, starvation, overdoses, domestic abuse, child abuse, the destruction and permanent closure of small businesses, depression, and so on and so on and so on. Those are curves they just don't care about, though, right? 8 months to flatten the curve. Sure. Oh, and in the meantime, while all those things are spiking out all through the roof, here's one Missouri landlord that just, you know, removed someone's front door because she couldn't pay her rent. Thanks, government. I'm sure glad you're looking out for all the small ones out there who can't afford their rent because you removed their job from them and you removed their income from them and you removed their livelihood from them and just broke their entire world. But yeah, let's remove her door because she can't pay rent. What happened to the moratoriums? What happened to anything they said would happen? Nope, it's all on you. But sure, just sit back, let them handle it, and take your vaccine like a dutiful citizen. Sure, that makes sense with all the obvious things we're looking at now. Obviously, this is the opposite of what you should be doing. This makes me horrified. This woman has a family. They removed her front door. Like, this is just disgusting. And guys, like we just talked about, 40 million people are right now at risk of losing their homes for Christmas. And your government is quibbling about to give you $600 or $1,000 in the next 451 pennies you'll get for the next so many. I mean, for all we know, this will be the last time you get anything. I'm arguing we shouldn't want anything from the government. But the point is that they destroyed your livelihood. So all that $4 trillion that went out to big business, who then went on to lay off all their employees, should have gone to you if they ever actually wanted to save the economy. But the only reason all this is happening is because they knew, in my opinion, that creating this illusion would drive them to create the world they wanted to create. As Derek Brose rightly wrote, in The Rise of Authoritarianism, from parasite stress theory to lockstep. As it says right here, and there's two different studies that say this. The idea is empirical evidence indicates that the spread of pathogens leads populations to become more conformist and accepting of authoritarian behavior from governments. And he asked, what does this mean for COVID-19? There's two studies that find this. It says the researchers also found that society tends to promote a collectivist worldview, favoring obedience and conformity from the population in response, and in the sense of these articles, parasites apply to either viruses, bacteria, anything. Any worry of some kind of an illness, such as a virus, their studies, more than one, have found that it drives individuals to conformity and to blindly trust their government and to inform on their neighbors. Now, if a government wanted to create something like this, as they point out in these studies, the first thing they could do is create a fake pandemic. It says, unfortunately, according to the parasite stress theory, humanity is prone to accepting violent behavior from governments during pandemics. As noted in Politics and Pathogens, the threat of exposure to a pathogen need not be even realistic for it to create a desire for conformity and obedience to authority. Now, you think your government doesn't know about these studies from years back? Do you think that they aren't aware that these things exist and studied them and realized that it's very useful in conjunction with the biosecurity state and the manipulation of the regulatory agencies? Of course they do. The only question you should be asking right now is whether they chose to use that for their benefit or for yours. Thank you for being here today, everybody, and I appreciate you thinking for yourselves, spreading the information, asking questions. Never been more important. I ask you now to wait 1 minute and jump over to our Twitter feed and check out where the link will be taking you next, because I'm going to be jumping on with Brian and going live on my Rockfin channel to talk about a bunch of other stuff. Thank you for being here, guys. I just cannot tell you how much you inspire me just by being here and asking questions and thinking for yourselves. You are leading the charge. I love you all, as always. Question everything. Come to your own conclusions. Stay vigilant.
What if the experts are wrong? What if quarantining the healthy doesn't actually save lives? What if wearing a mask in public is not effective?
If you do not have a mask, you cannot ride public transportation, sir.
My name is Dr. Jeff Barkey, and I'm here representing thousands of physicians across the country whose voices are being silenced because we don't agree with the mainstream media and the experts who are telling us what to do.
Everything I've seen in the last 9 days, all the things that just don't make sense, the patients I'm seeing in front of me, the lungs I'm trying to improve, have led me to believe that COVID-19 is not this disease, and that we are operating under a medical paradigm that is untrue.
Never in the history of this great republic have we quarantined the healthy. Never in the history of this great republic have we told churchgoers that it's illegal for you to exercise your First Amendment right of freedom of religion. Never in the history of this country have we been told that you can't go to church because it's non-essential, but you can go get an abortion because that's essential. Never before in our country have we let criminals out of jail, but we've told you you can't exercise your Second Amendment right and protect yourself by purchasing a firearm. When liquor stores are deemed essential, but your businesses are deemed non-essential, there's something wrong going on.
We cut off people's utilities this week and made them pay what could have been their last check to us to turn their lights on in a global health pandemic. But you don't care about that. You didn't want to meet.
This booklet, the Declaration of Independence and our U.S. Constitution, was never designed to restrain the people. It was designed to restrain the government. We're realizing that the fatality rate of this virus is in the ballpark of a bad seasonal influenza. Do not let your voices be silenced. We will see eventually that this government-imposed cure is going to be worse than the virus itself. But what's happening now as unemployment reaches 20 to 30 million people is those folks are now becoming dependent on the government. And what government dependency causes is a larger, more tyrannical government.
Look, he ain't even do nothing. He ain't even do nothing.
We the people want to put our government back in its place. We want a small representative government, not a large tyrannical government. I'm here representing thousands of physicians around the country whose voices must be heard.
We've never seen where we quarantine the healthy, where you take those without disease and without symptoms and lock them in your home.
So you guys are asking me to leave the store for not wearing a mask when I have a medical condition, even though yours is pulled under your nose.
A note that says
I don't have to bring a note, and yours isn't even on.
Just do whatever you want to do.
It's America, right?
Listen, get out.
I cannot wear a mask.
Get out.
Do not let your voices be silenced.